Let's try that again.
Hello, RJ, are you available? I don't know how to press the right button here.
I'm on board.
All right, terrific. So RJ asked that I chair the meeting since he's remote at the moment. So I will attempt to do so, although the eye charts that I've been provided are challenging. So calling the August 15th, 2022 Finance and Administration Committee meeting to order. This is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may alternatively participate remotely by using the toll-free call-in number on Zoom webinar link provided in the committee packet, which is posted on the SCV Water website. In the event there's disruption of service, which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not legally required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. Public comment during item two will be taken for items which are not on tonight's agenda, but are within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency. For items covered in the agenda, we will take public comment at the time each item is considered. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete and submit a public comment card to the administrator to help expedite this process. To participate in the public comment from a computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raise hand feature in Zoom when I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak. You'll be notified when it is your turn to speak, at which time you may unmute your device. To participate in public comment via phone, please dial *9 when I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it's your turn to speak, please dial *6 to unmute. As a reminder to staff who are presenting online, please mute all of your devices until you're ready to speak. When speaking, please turn on your camera and unmute your microphone. When you're finished presenting your item, please remute your microphone and turn off your camera. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments first from members attending in person and then those attending remotely. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. These will be taken in the order hands are raised. Committee then comes to a consensus to move the item to the board or not. Any PowerPoint presentations shown on tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCV Water website. All right, so everyone is present who's on the committee except for Maria Gutzeit, who is absent tonight. And RJ Kelly is participating remotely via Zoom. All right, so I'm first going to ask that we do the Pledge of Allegiance. Would Director Armitage please lead us in the pledge?
Yes, please stand. Place your right hand over your heart. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation.
All right. Do I have any public comments for items that are not on the agenda?
At this time, we do not have any public comment.
All right. Thank you. So, item three, and tonight is almost exclusively the Rochelle Patterson show. So lucky you. we're going to do the recommended approval of the revised customer service policy, item three.
Great. Okay. And today was a busy day, so I'm going to be on the fly. So the first item is recommending approval of a revised customer service policy. The revision does two things. It sets a application fee and a monthly fee for anyone who wants to opt out of the AMI or the AMR meters. And those are the advanced metering infrastructure, which is the AMI, and the AMR is automated meter reading. which allows, of course, the agency to read meters via radio frequency. We have had, we sent out two notices to customers, letting them know that we were looking to launch a, you know, a program. We applied for a grant to put in about 20,000 meters over the next 3 years for AMI technology. And we received, I think it was two letters asking if we had an opt-out for any number of reasons. So since we didn't have a fee or a policy for an opt-out program, we went out to our neighboring agencies and to look for anyone who else had AMI or AMR to see if they had the opt-out provision in their policy. So we did that. We also had three things that a customer needed to do before they could apply, which was they had to provide an application in writing, letting them know that they wanted to opt out and they were the customer of record, that the account is in good standing, and the account must not have any history of meter inaccessibility. So they can't put a rock on it or something where a customer service rep can't go by and read the meter. And then upon that verification, there is an application fee, which we've set at $75, looking at the survey and the amount of time that it would take in order to process the application. And we set the monthly rate at $30, which is the same rate as a reconnect charge during the day for somebody to manually go drive out, read the meter, and then move on with their day. There was a couple other items that were added for unauthorized water use and tampering, which the inspection group had wanted us to add and clarify. And it affects just a few sections of the policy, which is 6.2.11, 6.2.12, 6.2.14, and then a couple of the pages in the appendix, actually, where it shows what the rates are. And that concludes my report. And then the Finance Administration recommends to the Board of Directors to approve the attached revised customer service policy.
All right. Public comments on this item.
Let me just check here for you. Sorry, I've got a lot of screens open here on my desk. It appears we do not have any public comment at this time.
All right, terrific. So committee discussion. Looking, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Now, I'll just say that I appreciate you reaching out to the other water agencies to get an idea of what others are doing. The fees seem fine. At first, I was wondering if the $30 monthly charge? It seemed a little higher than the average when you looked at comparisons, but it makes sense to make it the same as a service call for the reconnection. So that sounds fine to me. I'm just wondering, a question that came up in my mind as you were doing your presentation, I know we've had the two requests. Did you ask the other agencies if what their percentage of opt-outs were? Because I imagine we will get more. So do we have kind of an idea of what that might be?
That was not part of our survey,
okay,
but
that's
we can
okay.
reach back out.
No, that's fine. I'm just wondering if maybe you had an idea, but no big deal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm good. I already asked my questions.
Perfect. Thank you. And does RJ have his hand up, or just RJ, if you
I'm fine.
Want to talk, yeah, if you want to talk, just go ahead and interrupt us verbally. That'd be fine with me.
Okay.
Thanks. So it sounds like this is a consensus to move this to the full board. I think it's pretty obvious that we could put it on consent. I can't imagine that we're going to have a huge line of people out the door eager to avoid Big Brother spying on the hole in their ground in the front of their house that meters their water. Yeah, not going to get a lot of information from that. So I think we can put that safely on consent. All right. Find the next thing here on my eye chart. Let's see. So the next item is the debt management policy. And we'll start again with Rochelle.
Yes, we have a very short PowerPoint, so throw that up. So let's go next slide. So just to briefly, the months and months ago, we had some discussion with our financial advisor. I think there were three meetings in a row of discussing different debt financing options, whether it's, you know, bond funded, state revolving fund, is, you know, WIFI program through the EPA, and just how those programs work. But we didn't really go beyond that discussion. So bringing the discussion back and starting it up again, I felt maybe we should go back to the debt management policy, because we did need to clarify and add a couple of items so we could look at state revolving fund or federal loans through the EPA and WIFIA. But then also maybe try to clarify some items on, you know, when it's appropriate to issue debt, and we can only issue debt if these conditions are met. So that was the intent of the revision of the policy. So that was the first bullet point of the adding in the US EPA for the Water Infrastructure and Finance Innovation Act with you in order to apply for those low cost financings. And then also the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, which is for the state's SRF program. One of the items to highlight that we added in, which wasn't part of the policy, is we wanted to make sure that any item that we were constructing with debt would last at least as long as the life of the loan. We didn't want to, you know, have a do a bond financing or a loan for an asset that would maybe last 5 or 10 years, that it should last at least as long as the maturity of the loan. And that, you know, there's a potential to use partial of our unrestricted cash reserves to offset future borrowings if it makes sense. Next slide. So this is small, quite small. Sorry. This is just a list. It's in the packet. It is attachment 2. It just lists so far what the engineers have identified as projects that could be funded by debt, or was previously identified as projects funded by debt. And they're typically the wholesale type functions with large reservoirs and water supply projects, dry year reliability wells. So these were the items that were identified as a debt financed. We can see that in the red at the very bottom, in the column below fiscal year 22-23, we had in the budget projected about $42, $41 million of projects. And we have about $18 million left of our 2020A bond proceeds, which leaves us short in the current year to complete the current year plan of $23 million. And if we add that to the 10-year forecast, it brings the need up to $343 million. Next slide. So this was their the policy considerations in section 1.1, and there could be other ideas also for this section of what we thought that long-term debt financings are appropriate for when the following conditions are met. We wouldn't want to fall below 80% of our target levels. And we want to make sure that our project meets our goals of equitable treatment of customers, and our total debt outstanding does not constitute an unreasonable burden to the agency and its ratepayers when it's fiscally prudent, responsible, and diligent under the prevailing economic conditions. When the debt is used to refinance outstanding debt in order to generate debt service savings. And if the projects are determined to be major non-reoccurring items or improvements with a minimum of 20 to 30 years of useful life. Next slide. Erica?
And I told Ed Colley that he was in good hands tonight.
Okay. Items that were added to 1.3, where the agency may use long-term debt financing subject to the following conditions of when the projects to be financed must be approved, of course, by the agency's board of directors. The agency estimates that sufficient revenues will be available to service debt through its maturity. The agency has determined that the assets being acquired have a long useful life, and the agency wants to allocate or distribute the cost of the asset among both current and future users. The availability of significant incremental and typical discretionary revenues, which includes capital reserves for the replacement of capital assets, is limited or restricted. And the agency determines that the issuance of debt will comply with all applicable state and federal laws. And the agency determines that the issuance of debt will comply with the existing financial covenants, which right now is 1.2. That's our debt coverage ratio. You know, other items to consider could be, you know, under section 1.1 is maybe we could add what types of projects could normally be financed. Maybe we identify what type it is, or should it be a cost threshold? Yeah, any project costing more than XYZ, you know, or we wouldn't issue debt if we saw our debt coverage ratio going below 1.4%, or some other type of options. But I figured at least if we get it out here, we can start discussing it and seeing if any of these changes make sense or if we need to add anything. So it was primarily a discussion. If everything's good, we could move it forward, but it's not imperative that it happen today. And that concludes my report.
All right. Thank you. I think we probably have some public comment.
We do have public comment. Cam Noltenmeyer, you may take the podium.
Cam, did you want to speak on the debt policy?
Yes, this is item number 4.
Yeah, you've mentioned our debt a time or two before, so this seems like a particularly appropriate time for the discussion.
Nothing has changed. Yes, we've had a very busy day, as you can tell. And I am concerned about what you are doing here. I don't think it's in the best interest of the ratepayers, but then nothing ever seems to be that way. I did have some places marked. It's all about recycled water. Is that not, am I correct? It's a recycled water issue. And, trucks are to be filled with potable water for irrigation. Then must either be filled through an air gap at the top of the tank. It seems like you're pushing almost any and every development, and that has been going on for a long time. And you're running around out of regular water, so you want to now treat water and let that be the compensation for a number of things. And this can't be good for what's going to happen in the long run, but it's what you're going to approve. And I'm just saying how much we are it says here, if these tank trucks are to be filled with potable water from irrigation, they must either be filled through an air gap at the top of the tank. It's creating all kinds of difficulties on keeping the difference in this water and where it's used, how it's used. And I don't see this company being able to handle that. But it's what you need so you can continue to approve developments and provide their water for them. And this seems to be the only purpose that I see of this agency. And I've been saying this for years. And I think that's becoming more and more evident now that we don't have as much water as you want for your developers. And the only thing you're thinking about is, well, we'll use this reclaimed water that you've been pushing for a long time. And to me, that's very disgusting of what's going on. And I'm sorry, I'm sure I'm out of breath, but we had a lot going on at home too today. And I had questions right. on Thank a you. Lot of things.
That completes your comment at this time. Okay. Thank you.
So I'm not sure what recycled water has to do with our debt policy, but I'll try to figure that out. All right. So full disclosure, Rochelle and I have engaged in some email exchanges back and forth, which helped me quite a bit. And I appreciate that. And so let me open it up for committee discussion. I will maybe preface that with saying that I kind of appreciate Rochelle's opening the door for this to be a multi-meeting discussion, which I think it ought to be. The last time we had this discussion, it lasted 3 or 4 meetings, and we didn't make as much headway as I think we should have. So I'm hoping that we can do this over multiple meetings and not just rubber stamp a policy. So please go ahead, whichever.
Thank you. So I also had some email communication with Ms. Patterson as well. Since I'm new to the committee and I'm trying to make sure I understand the issues related to this, I guess I'll just initially say that I think it's good that the language was added so that the federal and the state programs can be included as well. Since having been previously on the Public Outreach and Legislation Committee, I know that there's a ton of money that is going to be available to water agencies in the near future due to recent legislation that has been passed. So I'm glad that it feels like we're setting ourselves up to be able to receive funding that is available to us and that we can hopefully qualify for. So I'm glad to see that added. I know this discussion has been going on for a long time since I have been listening in on the back end during these meetings, and I have appreciated them. I think a lot of the questions that have been raised are valid, but I understand it is a very tough idea or tough concept to balance how much debt an agency our size should take on. You know, what is that magic number? Because this is a generational, a lot of these projects are multi-generational. And I don't know that we should burden our current customers and ourselves with all of the cost up front, right? And so I understand why there is a need for some debt funding, but what is the balance? You know, I think that's the magic question and that's the magic answer we're all seeking. So I appreciate this discussion. And I do think we're not going to solve it in one discussion either. I think it should take some time to get there. So one of the first questions I did ask Ms. Patterson is what are the guardrails? What are the guardrails for us as board members to help us understand, you know, if we take on additional debt, how much is appropriate? And what are the indicators that we as board members can look to understand this huge amount of numbers that are put in front of us to try to analyze and understand and make decisions based on? So I appreciated when she explained to me that part of kind of the guardrails on there are that, you know, the agency has to perform the analysis that's described in this memo. And also the debt coverage ratio, which is kind of that number we can look to, or at least one number we can look to kind of get a sense of some, that's not necessarily balance, but an indicator of what direction perhaps the amount of debt we are taking on is going. And so I asked if it'd be possible if we could have the debt coverage ratio included in the debt section of the financial report. So at least we see that number on a regular basis and we can monitor trends with that. And it was interesting for me to hear Ms. Patterson say that maybe perhaps we can put some type of parameters on the debt coverage ratio that we're comfortable with, that we can work within with or without permission to take on an additional debt. So I think that's something I'd like to have as part of the discussion. And perhaps there are more. So finance is not my strength. It's not, you know, my background. So I would be very interested in knowing if perhaps there are other types of indicators that we could also include that would be helpful for us to use as kind of for trend monitoring over time. So I think I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you.
Always love following Director Armitage. first of all, thank you. There was a lot of good information in the packet, so thank you so much for that. And I'm glad that this is a starting point, because I don't think we ever had an actual discussion. I don't think it was kind of like we had presentations, but I don't think we had a discussion. And since we're not allowed to discuss this outside of the meeting, I'm not afraid of having longer meetings, because I think that this is the place and the appropriate place to have these kinds of discussions. So there's that. I had a little tiny question that it's like a side note. I saw that there was a Newhall Avenue railroad crossing for $2.5 million. What's that? Do you know what that project is?
I don't know. At some point, there was a proposed pipeline to go under the railroad at Main Street, turns into Newhall Avenue right there by Hart Park. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a project proposed. I don't know if it's the same one to go under the railroad tracks. So I'm not quite sure if that's that or if it's a development. I don't think there's.
It's okay. I'll get an answer to that later on. That's totally fine. I think that we never really had this discussion about how we fund our projects. And I think that debt is one way. I think our PAYGO, you know, maybe should be dipped into a little. So I like the concept, the thought of maybe, you know, addressing what, how big a project needs to be for us to, you know, because I assume that there's some projects that we won't be able to take on unless we do incur some debt. But I would also like to see us be able to self-finance a little bit better, I think. But I'm wide open to creative thought. I mean, I know that there's people here that have a lot more strong opinions on the matter. And I'd like to, I'm always curious to know how people on the board are thinking, because different perspectives. My perspective is one thing, and there might be something that I haven't thought of that somebody else has. So with that.
Thank you. So RJ, did you want to chime in at this point?
Yeah, I also put in my time with Rochelle over a couple of days and talking about this, and I think I can summarize it, my position, in a couple of phrases. One, you know, we've got cash reserves that we've established for the longevity of the agency, and I would hate to see those cash reserves depleted by a large percentage. And, of course, PAYGO is going to potentially dip into our cash reserves. We also look at I do feel that rate increases are going to be something that's important as to what percentage of the rate increases that's going to continue with future discussion. And it's going to be hard to sell a rate increase when you've got a drought situation. Everybody's told to cut down on their water, which cuts down on our water bill, and then we turn around and do their rates. But it's got to be something that's sold as a necessity. And, of course, another tricky part of this entire thing is we look at our credit rating, and we just established a great credit rating. And, you know, if we go into debt financing with weakness, it could reduce our credit rating. And if it reduces our credit rating, it could end up causing us problems for future financing. So it's something else that we really need to consider. And then I believe in a conversation I had with Rochelle that there is a certain time frame on this, January or February, if I remember. You can correct me, Rochelle, if I'm wrong. But multiple meetings would have to have some type of a solution within a reasonable period of time. Do you remember what that time frame is, Rochelle?
Based on the engineer's estimate, sometime around February of 2023, the existing bond proceeds will have run out. So at that point, we would either need to have a decision to fund the remainder of the year and maybe next year's projects from reserves, defer some of those projects, or we could start establishing that reimbursement resolution. If we do go out for another bond issue, we would then would be able to recover the amount we're taking from reserves from the next bond issue. But February is the month.
And so you're looking at issuing a new bond, the time frame on issuing a new bond in general from start to finish?
I believe about 6 months is the is what's been used before. But with the reimbursement resolution, we can go back where construction costs 18 months. So we can, if we do borrow from ourselves, we can take longer than that 6 month period in order to get the next financing in place.
But during that 6 months, plus or minus whatever time period that we use our own funding, could end up being 6 months funding, 6 months on bond preparation, which adds another 6 months, takes us into a year of self-financing, just in that example.
Yes, and by using some of our reserves, we're showing the rating agency that we don't have the 1 year of liquidity that they like to see us have. So that's the other thing to look at if we go below the 365 days, that if we are going to have some other type of debt financing, that we should take that into account.
Yeah. So in general, it's a delicate teeter totter that we're sitting on in making the decision whether to be, you know, self funded, bond funded, going in with rates, et cetera, and coming up with the amount of funds we need. So I think I recapped it just in my bullet points, and Ed, take it back to you.
All right. Thanks, RJ. Yeah. So you'd make a good point that we should not and probably could not stretch this out for many, many months, although it sounds like we have a few months to work with, which I appreciate. Appreciate the staff bringing this forward with enough time to allow us to work on it diligently. So I could probably take the next, you know, I could go until midnight if I wanted to on this subject. So I don't even know where to begin.
Well, I think everybody had 10 minutes though.
appreciate that. So we can, there are multiple ways to skin this cat, so to speak. Obviously we can use cash on hand of some kind. We can borrow money. We can do combinations of that. We can also defer. And I would remind my fellow board members that while you weren't here, or not two of you weren't here, in the most recent economic nationwide worldwide disaster, this agency essentially shut down all projects that we had planned on doing. So we quit essentially investing in any capital for quite a number of years, really. And the world didn't end. I also, in that regard, could you bring up the list of projects that I chart that I could only see on the screen behind me? Is that possible? Probably.
It's probably, do you have your packet?
Well, yeah, I don't have that in front of me here, but that's, well, I was hoping to refer to it if that's possible. But so my point that I was going to make is that in the last 20 years, we have accomplished, yeah, there you go. That's the one. So in the last 20 years of my being on the board, we have done one project that I would call, that I think at the time we called, regional storage. So we have a great many water tanks that have a dual purpose. They store water and they provide pressure for different pressure zones. And then we have three major regional tanks, one or locations of regional tanks. We have tanks at both of our water treatment facilities. And then in the last 20 years, and it's been nearly 20 years ago, I think, we completed the project on the east end, the Sand Canyon Reservoir. And so we have three large regional storage tanks. When I looked at this, I found several new regional storage tanks that are totaling somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million that engineering is suggesting that we're going to complete in 10 years. So the Magic Mountain Reservoir and the second Magic Mountain Reservoir, the expansion of the Sand Canyon Reservoir, and it's yet to be identified location, Southern Service Area Reservoir. So that is four more regional storage, or an average of 2.5 of them a year. And again, we've done one in the last 20 and three in the last 60. So when we look at these projects, I think it would behoove of the board as a general to sort of go through and try to figure out, one, what's realistic on timing, and two, what do we really need as far as timing? I find it unlikely that we're going to need four huge, new, expensive, very expensive, $100 million worth of reservoirs over the next 10 years. So I think there's a lot of work that can be done as an agency to scrub this list and look harder and figure out what do we really need. Okay. So, I mean, the LARC pipeline is needed and in progress and funding, and that mixed in with a, south end reservoir that I don't think is going to happen in my time on the board. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 10 years. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 20. So that's part of the discussion I think we need to have, is what can we defer so that we can do pay-as-you-go financing, so that we can anticipate in future rates the need for more capital funds. Director Armitage, you asked a question about what rails, what sorts of indicators. If we borrow the amount suggested in the staff report for this year, we'll be using more than half, I think, of our tax revenue in just debt financing. Okay. That means that we have less than half of that revenue available to pay for something we need ongoing. The system, we talk a lot about this generational equity, and leaving my children with debt is not the equity that I think of as being is being what I want to do. Many of us will leave our houses, for example, to our children fully paid off. I may well do that. I may get to that point if I live a few more years. The house won't be perfect when they get it. It's going to have, you know, the carpeting needs to be replaced. There's a few things wrong here and there. I'm not going to tell you all of them. But much like our systems, they're not perfect. We discover all the time we have things which are less than perfect. We have manifolds at pumping plants that don't line up. We have, just over the last 20 years, there's been a great number of things that we've had to go back and fix. And so our children are going to have to fix our system. We have a great number of pipes in the ground right now that we're having trouble with leaks that we need to fix. And that costs money. Our children are going to have those kinds of problems ongoing. And so if we're going to burden them with a huge debt that consumes virtually all, if we do another $350 million, it will consume a large portion of the tax proceeds that we have coming in that historically gone to pay for capital. And they won't have anything left to fix those problems. And so my preference is generally to, I'll try to summarize my thought here, is to one, try to push out things which we do not need in the short term to, you know, a more realistic time frame or when they're actually needed. And to have our rates commensurate with our need for capital improvements so that we can, in the midterm, I think we can draw down debt. We're going to be actually in the not too distant future, our debt payments will go down significantly because we're paying off as we go. And at that point, if we don't incur new debt, we will have millions of dollars a year available to do PAYGO out of our tax stream. So that would be my preference. And particularly in light of the current interest rate environment, I think it becomes even more important to not incur new debt if we can avoid it. So short term, I believe that we actually have sufficient money in reserves to meet that 80%. And use 20% of our reserves to fund this year's and a good chunk of next year's capital needs. And we can then, by pushing things off some, we can likely forego, I would hope, any new debt incurrence.
Director Colley, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Over here at Zerka.
Yep.
I just wanted to bring to your attention that Chief Engineer Courtney Mail is on the line. He'd like to speak.
Oh, I'd love to hear from Courtney.
Okay.
Thank you, Courtney. I appreciate your willingness to chime in.
See.
No problem. Thank you very much.
You have a camera, Courtney? If not critical. I just...
Okay, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I hear you, Courtney.
Yeah, I'm working from home. I just came to listen to the meeting. I didn't realize exactly what was being discussed. I should have paid more attention. And then I would have been there in person. But yeah, the projects that you're going over and you're describing probably need more detail. I understand what you're saying, that you want to take a more detailed look at these projects, but there are obviously purpose and reason behind each one of the projects that we have listed on there. Primarily, like you would give the example of the regional storage reservoirs that we have to complete one every 2.5 years or so. The regional storage we are deficient in across this valley. We are supposed to be trying to achieve to get between 7 and 21 days of emergency storage if we are to lose our primary supply. And we don't have that currently, as detailed in an emergency storage report that came out. So that's the purpose of those projects. Obviously, large cost reservoirs are not ideal, and we've been working actively to get them, but they do take more time than just a standard reservoir. So we can take a look at that and see what the realistic timeline is for those projects to come online, and we will present that to the board. But each one of these projects that's on the list has a need. This list is based on a number of different reports from the different agencies. Obviously, the master plan will also help further refine this list. But as it is, this is engineering's opinion of a pared down list. And we can look at that further to see if there's anything else we can do, and certainly can come back to the board with explanations as to the necessity of these projects. Obviously, we do that as an individual project basis as well by doing a report before it's approved. But I don't know if you wanted to see more than that on a larger report. At the engineering committee, we do usually go into more detail on any project that exceeds $1 million, explaining its need and justification. I think we even brought that back to the board in the last board meeting when we described these projects. So we'd be welcome to do that again.
Yeah, Courtney, I don't want you to misunderstand my point. I'm not questioning that these are valuable projects. There are many, many things in life that one can identify as needed or wanted or desirable or whatever. And then we oftentimes in life end up with a collision with our finances. And I think I need a new car, but my finances say otherwise. So I choose to not buy a car at this time, despite the fact that I think that I can make a case for why I need it. So that's not the, I don't want you to misunderstand and say that I believe in no way am I suggesting or intending to suggest or want you to read into what I'm saying that somehow or another engineering is fluffing this up and making up and just putting together pipe dreams of what would be cool to have. That's not my point. But your participation does bring to the fore, I think, an issue that is a problem in this agency, and that is, in some regards, in some ways, effectively, the engineering department and committee hand the finance committee a bill and essentially say, pay this. And I think as an entire board, we need to be more comfortable with that junction between our finances and desirable projects. So again, I hope you understand that I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to suggest that the engineering department is not in fact doing their job by bringing forward every project that would enhance our system. I believe that these would. Although, Courtney, let me ask just a really quick question. If we have 21 days of supply of treated water, is that water going to be usable given the disinfectant byproduct problems that we have with treated water that is grown stale? Can you answer that?
Yeah, we're not trying to target 21 days. We're trying to target 7 and see from there. But we're not at 7 yet, which is really the minimum we would want. There will be some reservoir management that would go along with these costs that are part of the project planning. And I appreciate your position. I appreciate what you are saying. I just wanted to offer the opportunity to go into more detail about the necessity of these projects. If that's what you would want more information on to make that decision.
Yeah, that's certainly, and frankly, that discussion can't happen at just the finance committee because we should not and do not trump, so to speak, the engineering committee, nor does the engineering committee trump this committee. So I think that this discussion does need to be brought to more of the full board eventually at some point. So thank you, Courtney. And really, truly, I sincerely appreciate your chiming in and offering to speak. And yeah, well, this wasn't any attempt to ambush you in any way, shape, or form.
No, thank you. I'm here to answer. There was also a question about a railroad project from Director Bronstein. Did you want me to answer that question as well?
Oh, yes, please.
So you were asking what that project is. It's connecting two different pressure zones, formerly two different water agencies, by a pipeline underneath Railroad Avenue. We would be going underneath the railroad, most likely via tunneling or directional drilling, depending on which method we can is most affordable.
Thank you. And that's really cool.
By the time you get permission from the railroad, 20 years will have elapsed anyway. So, and the cost will have quadrupled. So anytime you're dealing with a railroad and crossing their tracks, other than by walking across, it's long and expensive.
Director Colley, I just have a couple comments for discussion.
Please.
Just wanted to go back to the discussion on property tax and the amount that's available for PAYGO. Our annual debt service payment is $32 million. We bring in about $34, $35 million from property tax. The way that the new rate structure is, so it's different when it was CLWA, because there wasn't any capital component in the rates, the wholesale rates. The only portion of capital was the debt service payments, which was taken out of property taxes, which is correct. But with the agency and its new rate case, all revenues are compiled together. If you look through the budget, right, revenues, property tax. So I just want to let you know that it's not really separated like that anymore. So the way that we get our PAYGO number, PAYGO is the last thing to get paid. Last thing to get construction. So we add up all our revenues and we take out our expenses and then our debt service, and then whatever's left over is available for PAYGO. So we have roughly about $16 million average over the 5-year period from our current rates. So when we look at our 10-year forecast, it averages about $35 million for PAYGO projects. So not only are we not going to be able to do all of our PAYGO projects from our existing rates, we will not be able to do any of our debt service projects from our existing rates either.
Can I ask a quick question on that? So if you have $35 million a year for 10 years, that's $350 million. And then I look at this number, 343, which is less than 350.
Right. So that's just debt finance. So there's two project lists. This one is one that have been identified for some type of debt financing.
Okay.
We have another list that is PAYGO. And PAYGO is, like you said, pipeline replacements, pump replacements. It's not the new asset. It's just replacing something we already have, right? Like kicking the can, 30 years down the road, people are going to have to start fixing that thing. Well, that's what our PAYGO is. Technology improvements, all of that. So that's about $35 million a year.
Okay. That I missed that part of it. So I appreciate that explanation.
So I just wanted to, when we look at the debt management policy, and then we look at, our rates and what's coming from PAYGO, and then what we would need to do, even if it's a refined version of this debt funded list, we can't take it all from reserves because we wouldn't have the cash. We're not collecting enough even to do the PAYGO projects every year. So what do we use our reserves on? Debt funded projects, PAYGO projects? That's will have to be a discussion. And then also, what do we do with next year's debt funded projects? So if we look at, if we want to use say 20% of our current reserves to complete this year's capital, we could do that. But next year's capital, we have some immediate needs. We have $38 million of PFAS projects that we know need to get constructed. Where does that money come from? Are we going to dip into reserves again? Because we know it's not coming from rates because it's not paying for 100% of our paygo. So that's what starts this discussion of what do we need to, you know, to do? How can we do it smartly? We can try to pull some from reserves, have maybe reduce our next type of debt financing based on maybe a more a realistic list from our capital projects. And then, you know, look at a plan. If we're pulling from reserves, you know, can we plan to recover those reserves in our next rate case? Maybe over the 5-year, you know, term to start recovering those. And then start building up our paygo through rates every year with small incremental increases in order to get that $35 million. Now, are we going to have $35 million or every year of paygo projects? Maybe not. Then it can be used for those debt projects that have been identified. But that's kind of the discussion that, you know, I was hoping that we would get started of. So we all know kind of the enormity or the complexity of our paygo projects and our debt funded projects, knowing the limited resources we have. And then how would we, if we use those, how would we go back and recover them?
All right. So I think I ought to invite another round of comments here, if that's appropriate. Please go ahead.
So I was wondering, I know this is kind of hard to do, but like, what does $10 million look for to a customer? What would the increase on their bill look like?
So we just did one analysis. And I had originally picked, instead of the 20% from reserves, I'd pick $16 million because that's how much is in our capital reserve. So we could pull, if, you know, if we do this policy, we could pull, you know, 20%, but the capital reserve has $16 million in it. So if we take out $16 million and in our next rate case, which is fiscal year 26 through fiscal year 31, if we recover that $16 million, plus we want to start building up our paygo to get to $35 million by the end of that 5-year period, we're looking about 8% per year. Right now we're doing 6.5. So what does just $10 million mean? I can't tell you today.
So what does it roughly like translate on somebody's bill?
On a customer's bill, the 8% is about $6.50, I think it was. I'm looking at Darlene because she knows. Actually, I think I might have that.
And then I was going to say, out of curiosity.
It's $6.60.
$6.60. Awesome. Roughly.
Right. 16, that's in fiscal year 28. So in 26, it's $5.66, $6.11, $6.60, $7.13. So it will just, and that's at 8%. We knew that we were probably going to have to do some type of increase just for inflation anyway, you know, 4%. So we were looking at adding another 4%, and that's about the impact. It goes from $2.83 to $5.66. But that's just one scenario. And I think I mentioned to all of you in some communication that next month, we are already looking at presenting some type of scenarios and to see what rates would look like, what revenue we would have to generate in order to, you know, pay ourselves back for whatever amount we decide is comfortable taking out of reserves, recovering that. And then what is our goal? Do we want to build up to the $35 million? So 100% of our paygo is coming from rates. What's that good number? But that's the number we use. Taking our 10-year forecast for paygo, if you average it out, it's about $35 million. So that's was my anticipation of next month's discussion to kind of get over through some guidelines this month of just saying, okay, well, are we comfortable with what has been added to the debt management policy? Do we want to add anything to the debt management policy? Do we want to take anything out? And again, it starts that discussion, but then it will put, you know, real numbers around the, you know, what we're thinking about or in theory.
I was also going to say that you were saying that last time when we weren't around in 2007, right? You guys paused a lot of things. I'm guessing that all of the agencies, because we weren't one agency at the time, right? In 2007.
Yeah, I can tell you Santa Clarita Water Division did as well. And I imagine New Hall and Valencia had a similar reaction.
It wasn't just the downturn in the economy. It's actually around the drought, too, in 2000. I can't remember if it was 11, 14, because that's when, you know, we saw all of our revenues, you know, get reduced. So there wasn't that available cash for capital.
I would also comment that as the recovery started, the agency found itself in sort of a positive bid environment, a bid environment that was where we thought we could get things done a little bit cheaper, and did. And so we did a bit of a increase, I think, over what we might have otherwise done to take advantage of that, which maybe is a factor in today's discussion, in that construction costs today are outrageous. Labor is impossible to find. Materials are impossible to find. Anything we buy today is frightfully expensive. So,
I mean, I'm looking at this stuff here, and I think that the conversation, it's important to look at these things, definitely. And I think that Mr. Mia will probably be able to give us better guidelines. And as you said, it should be a discussion for all the board, not just here at finance, because we're only a fraction of the board and we should all be on board with it. At the same time, I think we need to also, though, have a discussion of, if hypothetically we do want to incur debt, hypothetically, what would those guidelines be? I think they're just two different conversations, if that makes any sense.
Because the projects would have to be approved.
Right. So as in, we can have a discussion about, but I mean, I don't see how we're, I mean, there's Asagas dry year reliability wells 5 and 6 that are what, $42 million? You know, there's things here. I mean, I was just looking at the wells, and that's like $100 million right there. But the question, I mean, I would say that with the drought, those are even more important for us to invest in. Because, you know, water. So as I said, I think that we need to do both things and not make the policy is going to have to be adopted by the whole board. And honestly, I think this conversation needs to be with everybody else, regardless of my own personal feelings on the matter. And I think that we do need to discuss, if hypothetically we were, what kind of guidelines would we like to see, and just try to start giving some kind of direction of a hypothetical situation. If it may or may not occur, that's another issue.
Please.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I'll just say that I feel, I hesitate to delay any of the projects that have to do with water quality. I think that the PFAS treatment projects have to absolutely happen. I just had a discussion last week where I realized how many wells we have that actually have PFAS water in them, and it scares me a little bit. I'd like for us to move as quickly as possible on those. And you know, the VOC projects and the perchlorate projects. So I think water quality projects should stay at the top of the list, absolutely. But beyond that, I feel like it would be very helpful, I think, for all of us board members to have a better understanding of the projects on these lists, and kind of a ranking criteria that perhaps the engineering staff, that makes sense to them, but that you could communicate to us so that we understand it. I think that would be very helpful. And then having the scenarios put out in front of us that you were describing, you're going to come back to us next month. I think that's going to be very helpful for me, at least, to figure out what direction my mind's going with that, so that we can see the impact, and particularly the impact to the ratepayers, I think will be really important. So I'm looking forward to those pieces of information in my mind to kind of further discussion in a way that would make sense to me and be logical.
And those pieces are in the revised debt management policy. So all of that analysis, all of that would have to come to the board, and the projects would come to the board prior to any type of debt being issued. So like you said, there's two issues. One, of course, is projects and how much and when, what's realistic do we want to do? But bringing it back full circle to the debt management policy, are there other conditions that we should add here that don't fit into one of these boxes that we've already talked about?
Chairman Colley?
Please go ahead. Yeah, just talk.
I think a lot of things have been crisscrossed and done a good job of it. But I would also like to remind people that a budget is not a final end result, obviously, and the projections on what we're going to be spending on these projects is not a final either, simply because we know in the past we've had projects that have been pulled for various different reasons. And out of $300 million, there's a possibility of some things being pulled, and there's also a possibility of some things being added. So in looking at everything, we have to recognize that this may or may not be the final completed value, but we're going to be financing based on these numbers.
All right. Thank you. So what I heard from Michelle is an offer to bring back next month some scenarios, and they will put some numbers to, you know, to show that maybe my pipe dream of never issuing debt again is just flat out unrealistic. But that maybe we can pare down. So I would love to see some of those thoughts that you've got on what directions we might take. I would remind the members of the committee that it's always difficult when we talk about a percentage increase. So Rochelle mentioned a 8% increase in rates. That's not an 8% increase in the cost to the consumer. We have this strange phenomenon, our tax, our ability to tax our ratepayers kind of comes with an indirect sort of, it makes any increase that we put on the rates look as if it's outstripping inflation or is much too high. Okay. And yes, admittedly, the signal is going to say, oh, there's an 8% increase in their water rates. Well, that's kind of technically maybe true, but it may really only be a 4%. It may be something, it has been often the case that we are significantly below inflation in our total money that we collect from our water users. So, I'm glad that we have that ability to gain some of the taxes that people pay on their 1% property tax. And I'm sure that if they understood that, it's a good thing for them, but it's unfortunate that we always talk about percent increase in rates because that's the only knob we have available to us. So I just wanted to point that out. The percentage increase may not really be a very good indicator of the story. Anyway, so my inclination, oh, please go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Rochelle if you're looking for direction as far as like a saying, hey, if it's a water quality related issue, then yes, we're willing to issue debt for that. Is that kind of what you're asking here?
I'm thinking that just maybe too granular, you know, projects that have been approved by the board of directors. I mean, that would be, it could be something other than water quality, depending on maybe what's happening in that particular time. So just having it approved by the board of directors prior to issuing debt, I think is broad enough for us to, you know.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out.
Chief engineer to take this list to you and say, okay.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out what else you need from us.
So that was my question. If we are bringing back the debt management policy, what would you like to see different?
Go ahead, please.
I threw out earlier the suggestion about having parameters around the debt. What is it? Debt something ratio. I can't think of it right now.
Yes. So the debt ratio is in there. Doesn't necessarily debt ratio. It says within the bond covenants, but we can identify. We can describe what the debt coverage ratio.
Right, and then so maybe the board can define what's that range that they're comfortable with. And I couldn't answer that right now. I don't even know what number to throw out to suggest. But that maybe is a discussion to have that could put some parameters on what would be acceptable.
That's okay. just for your information. That's really it's a metric that's used by the lenders to make them comfortable that we can, in fact, and are maintaining our ability to repay. I'm not sure that its value to us is anywhere near as high, but that's my own.
whatever similar. I'm just trying to find an indicator for us to use. So, if whatever you can think of, or anybody else in the financial world, if there's a similar type of indicator. That would give us that hub of information. That's what I'm trying to like point us towards.
Yeah, I mean, a number that I would be thinking is more valuable is percentage of income that needs to be used for debt. That's something I use in my own personal life more than anything that resembles a debt coverage ratio. So. Anyway, yeah, maybe next month we could discuss more in detail what that number is and why it's a value to the lenders and what its value to us might be.
I did get some notes from Director Gutzeit, and it has to do with putting this similar information in 1.1 and 1.3 in the short term. There is in the policy, there's a really small paragraph for short-term debt, and there should be some type of criteria around when we would issue short-term debt and what does that mean. So next month, when I propose this again, I will try to attempt to use a similar criteria for short-term debt as we use for long-term debt, getting agency approval. And
yeah, I mean, we would never really proposed to use short-term debt other than as a bridge to long-term debt, I think. So
it would follow the same criteria. Okay. Projects would have to be
approved. Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah. If it's a bridge to long-term debt, yeah, you would
Excuse me, Director Colley. Don't mean to interrupt again. I just wanted to bring to your attention, General Manager Matt Stone would like to speak.
Oh, by all means, Matt.
Okay, let me see if I can get everything set up here.
Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate Courtney raising his hand. I was waiting patiently for you to complete your remarks to give a probably less articulate version of his answer. So thank you for that, Courtney. In listening to the discussion, I think there are a couple of key points that I want to make sure we capture or retain tonight so that we can make progress. I think my observation from the last round of discussions is we did talk about a lot of things, but we struggled a little bit with bringing on board key points to shape out a policy. So this has been, I think, a very productive discussion in that respect. Rochelle made the observation, and we've discussed it at the executive staff level, that our current rate projection for the first five-year rate case of the agency essentially generates about $15 to $20 million of available cash to do PAYGO projects. And looking out into the future, projects that we would certainly not recommend debt financing, reservoir recoats, pump replacements, component maintenance, that kind of thing. We're looking at, I think it was $35 to $40 million a year. So I think one thing that would be beneficial in this discussion would be to get the committee staff and then ultimately board on the same page that that's a direction we need to move in when we revisit rates the next time, that we need to essentially design rates that will generate sufficient money to hit those PAYGO amounts for just the, I kind of think of that as your base level PAYGO. You know, this is what you really should be spending at a minimum on PAYGO. And then I think if there is a desire to cash finance some of the more traditionally financeable capital projects or to fund a portion of it with cash, then that could be an additional amount that we would look to generate from rates. And looking at the sensitivity of what that does, I think will help us. I think these goals could be revisited, you know, from time to time as we make progress on that. But the first kind of hurdle, I think, is getting from the 15 to 20 million in PAYGO generated to the 35 to 40 million in PAYGO over some manageable period of time. And that was the main comment. We kind of touched on it, and I think there's some good questions around that, but I wanted to offer my perspective that strategically, I think that's a really important thing for the agency to undertake so that over time that happens and the ratepayers are left in a better net position by not having to debt finance things that are even normally PAYGO projects.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate you chiming in always. So any more comments, concerns, things that we want? Rochelle, I didn't hear anything real specific that we wanted as far as wordsmithing the document, although I think that that's going to happen somewhat. But to Matt's comment, the problem is always when it actually comes down to doing a rate increase, we all know that I've never had a constituent come to me and say, I want to pay more for my water. Everybody always comes to the board and says, we want to pay less. We don't like rate increases. And so it's easy as a politician to simply say, well, then I'll just, you know, I'll debt finance and then you can pay more later when I'm not on the board. But I'd like to be more responsible as a politician and consider the not kicking the can down the road, as I frankly believe that we have too much too often over the last 60 years. So, which is part of what makes today's difficult conversation so difficult, because we have to pay the debt that we've incurred by past boards. So, Rochelle, do you have enough direction, you think, to bring something forward that would help us for a discussion next month?
I think the debt management policy will primarily stay the same. We'll just reintroduce it again. We may find something that we can add as we go through the analysis process. So we'll just bring back the policy along with the analysis discussion. And then potentially maybe add something to the policy so we can get it to the board to get that policy approved.
Okay. I don't, the fact that it also contains WIFIA and whatnot, I don't think that prevents the board from moving forward with specific loans, right? You wouldn't think that the lack of this policy.
Well, I don't think so, but we do have our financial advisors on the next item. So we could probably ask them, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I can't imagine why it would. All right. So I will wrap up that item. Thank you, Rochelle. All right. So I'm going to move to item 5. So approval of completing a letter of interest for the WIFIA program.
So just a brief introduction before we start the presentation. This is We have an opportunity September 6th. The EPA opens their program to receive letters of interest in an effort to finance with low interest for certain water system type projects. And pretty much it looks like most of all of our projects on that list would qualify under the WIFIA program. Of course, there are some other criteria about, building with U.S. materials and those types of things, but I think that might be in the presentation. So Laura Carpenter from Fieldman Roll-Up will be presenting along with Robert Poor and their team to go over what the WIFIA letter of interest is and what the program would look like and what the potential savings for the agency could be if it hypothetically had a 10-year debt program of, $340-350 million. If we received some WIFIA financing at a lower cost interest and then traditionally bond financed the other 51% or some combination of cash or something else, of what that might save the agency customers in the long run. So I will turn it over to Laura Carpenter.
Thank you very much, Rochelle, and good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's our pleasure to be here this evening with you all. If you recall, we are assisting the agency with its debt funding plans, as well as looking at its overall capital improvement program. We had the opportunity to present to the committee and the board late last year in connection with the options that an agency like yourself has to keep financing or funding through all different measures and means, your type of capital improvement program, which, as Rochelle has been identifying, is a large program for both debt and PAYGO needs. The ultimate question will be, from the board's perspective, is what types of projects can be deferred. From engineers' perspective, which ones are the high priority projects to keep in mind. What we're looking at today is really an opportunity that we think could bring into the agency and put additional tools in your tool shed, so to speak, for those long-term capital projects that might be more economic to debt finance. I think this is a very timely conversation, especially considering the discussion we just had on the prior item regarding the debt management policy. The policy really is going to help identify what types of projects the board has approved and would like to utilize in a debt-funded capacity, and then utilizing your overall financial pro forma, the types of funding that's coming in for PAYGO projects, the types of rates that are coming in for revenue that can meet existing debt, but also future potential PAYGO debt and debt-funded projects. That's what we're trying to identify here today, is really what are your options on a debt-funded capacity. And one of those options we wanted to go in a little more detail is the WIFIA loan. We do recall from our prior educational presentation late last year, the board and finance committee wanted to hear a little bit more about this program. And as Rochelle identified, it's timely to do it now, considering they are opening up an additional round of financing, which we are going to go to in more detail in these coming slides. So Erica, if you don't mind, I think we'll start with slide 3 of the presentation, which just gives a brief overview of, again, what the WIFIA program is and what they've accomplished to date. Thank you, Erica. So just for a quick recap, WIFIA stands for Water Infrastructure and Finance Innovation Act. It was established in 2017 by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and it was mostly established for agencies such as yourself to fund eligible water and wastewater infrastructure projects. The one key program term is that this WIFIA loan financing can only fund up to 49% of eligible project costs. However, what EPA does allow is for its borrowers to take 51% of the project costs and fund it with cash on hand, reserves, any types of grants available and applied to, as well as governmental loans, additional loans, such as a state revolving fund loan, or even long-term debt-funded bonds through the public market or private placement loans. So to date, the WIFIA program has closed almost 89 loans, totaling $15.4 billion, which through its credit assistance program has helped to finance almost $33 billion in water, infrastructure, and wastewater projects. Since its start application of the act that was enacted for the first round of financing. WIFIA program has selected almost 192 projects across the nation. And you'll see some of those states highlighted in the map to the right. And in total, those selected projects have requested nearly $30 billion for applicable water and wastewater projects that are eligible under this program. And in future slides, we'll go over what types of those projects can be applied for WIFIA funding. But in general, it's really all of your 10-year CIP programs do meet most of those requirements. Next slide, please. What we are identifying here on this slide is, again, recapping some of the key benefits the WIFIA loan program can provide to the agency. The first point we wanted to iterate is regarding the interest rate that will be garnered from closing the WIFIA loan. At the date of closing, you'll be able to fix out the interest rate for the entire program, and it's going to be based off of the U.S. Treasury rates for a similar weighted average life of your loan plus 0.01%. What makes this program really beneficial for borrowers is there's no additional credit spread besides that 0.01% above the similar maturity of the weighted average life for the U.S. Treasury. So in comparison, if there were to be two agencies closing a loan on the same exact date, the credit rating of each of those agencies will not determine or affect the interest rate generated. If both loans had the same exact weighted average life, they would both receive that same day's U.S. Treasury rates plus 1.01%. There is a requirement that all borrowers have an investment grade rating, which the agency does have with its outstanding bonds from both S&P and Fitch. There are additional flexible terms that we wanted to go over here and have bulleted here on this slide, one of which is you can customize your repayments of the WIFIA loan. What that means is the agency has already outstanding, as Rochelle mentioned, about $32 million of debt service costs. Any issuance of a WIFIA loan can structure the new debt to wrap around all existing debt service payments in order to not burden ratepayers in any specific year by utilizing a level payment. The state revolving fund loan only requires or only allows level principal and interest payments, whereas EPA allows you to structure the debt as you see fit to benefit ratepayers and your existing debt service schedules. In addition, the agency will not have to repay the loan during the entire construction period of the projects identified for the program. What that means is if you have a 5-year construction window, your repayments will not have to start until year 6. Then you can repay the loan for an additional 35 years. And to put that in perspective, a typical bond issuance, such as the one you issued in 2020, the term of a bond issuance in the public market usually goes about 30 years. And the EPA program is allowing you to go 35 years plus deferment of any repayment during construction. If an agency so chooses, and if it's approved by the EPA, you can additionally defer those interest payments up to 5 years beyond substantial completion of the project if it's economic to do so. And as I mentioned before, while EPA only provides 49% funding, you are able to utilize outside funding sources such as grants and cash, and also match that 51% with additional governmental loans or long-term bonds or cash, as I noted earlier. One very key benefit of this program as well is, unlike a bond issuance, where you usually have a 10-year lockout period before you're allowed to prepay or refinance with lower interest rates at the time of prepayment, WIFIA loan allows a borrower to prepay on an annual basis at $1 million minimum requirements. So if the agency has additional funds from its PAYGO capital projects or additional funds from rates, on an annual basis, you are allowed to prepay the loan with funds on hand, which is a very attractive term that is hard to quantify in the market. Additional flexibility terms the WIFIA program provides is it does allow, upon approval from EPA, to subordinate the loan, which means all of your debt is located on the senior lien, if minus the 1999 BABs, which aren't a super senior lien. If you were to need to subordinate this program, EPA allows you to do so. This is unlike, again, the state revolving fund loan, which does require its loan to be on the senior lien for all outstanding debt. And the last bullet point here that we wanted to bring up with the committee is that there is a requirement if you were to utilize WIFIA loans that you can't fund your project with federal governmental funds higher than 80%. So if you were able to generate a 49% WIFIA loan, you would only have 31% remaining capacity for a federal grant, would be one example. The state revolving fund loan does not constitute a federal loan. So that's why you can utilize, for example, a full 51% share from the state revolving fund loan if that was an acceptable and attractive program, if the state approved that type of program for the agency. Next slide, please. You might be asking why now? And as we discussed just briefly, as well with Rochelle's introduction, the EPA is opening up its 2022 federal funding round, which it has up to $5.5 billion of Congress-supported funding, which can support up to $11 billion in applicable and eligible water infrastructure investment. They're opening up what they're classifying as a rolling fund or rolling application round starting September 6th. So applicants will be able to insert or apply to a letter of interest starting on September 6th. The EPA will review all letter of interest within an 8-week period. And then as they select projects, they will reduce the amount of funding available for new projects or new letter of interest submissions. And they will continue to accept loans and applicants up until their current year funding is exhausted, or until they issue a new notice of funding availability for an additional fiscal year of funding. What we wanted also to identify here on this slide is what are the current project criteria for the selection rounds for 2022. EPA really is looking into projects that are addressing PFAS and emerging contaminants, which we do understand are some of your high priority projects in this 10-year CIP. They're looking for any type of projects that remove lead in water and wastewater systems, any projects that help service areas that are economically stressed, and of course, any projects that are innovative and that assist in climate change or resiliency for those types of benefits. What we have shown in the chart to the right is a list of the projects that are eligible under WIFIA. One key aspect is anything that you would apply to and that is acceptable under the state revolving fund loans, both drinking water and the clean water program will also be applicable and eligible under the WIFIA loan program. There's also additional bullet points here listing projects such as desalination, any kind of energy efficiency projects, drought prevention, reduction, or recycling projects. And lastly, you can acquire funding for the acquisition of property or a combination of projects secured by a common source. And really, this last bullet point is what we are looking to assist the agency in funding and preparing an application for a multitude of a combination of all of your 10-year CIP projects. And you can do that through what we classify a master agreement, which was just instituted and prepared by the EPA only for this year and this round of funding, I think with an addition to partial clients who applied for last year funding as well. But as Rochelle mentioned, there are additional requirements for projects that are funded through the WIFIA loan program, and that's in connection with the federal cross-cutter provisions. We've listed here some of the requirements for the projects that are needed, such as NEPA, Davis-Bacon, American Iron Steel, and BABA, Build America, Buy America Act. These types of projects do need to meet these construction materials. There is, however, and has been released a waiver for the BABA Act, which requires any project that has started design prior to May 14th, 2022, can waive the BABA requirement, which might help significantly reduce costs by avoiding this BABA requirement. And we would assist the agency in utilizing this waiver and apply to it for the projects that are eligible to receive it. Next slide, please. So what exactly is a master agreement and why are we utilizing it and requesting it in this type of application and letter of interest program? What we have done for other clients, we've been working on two master agreements as well for some of our existing projects who are currently looking to apply to the WIFIA program. But in general, a master agreement is really just a contract between EPA and the borrower where it allows for an upfront commitment of eligible project costs and loan proceeds. Utilizing that master agreement, the agency will be able to fund multiple individual loan agreements over a 3 to 5 year period for projects that are ready to go or ready to proceed in their given construction timelines. So in general, a borrower would have one full master agreement that can fund projects over a 10-year CIP window. And then as those projects become eligible or become start construction over a 3 to 5 year window, that's when you start to execute those loan agreements, those individual loan agreements with EPA. What this master agreement structure does is it allows the agency to streamline and prepare common terms of legal covenants and provisions that are accepted day one. It then allows for a more streamlined approach for applying and actually closing individual WIFIA loan agreements for those underlying project requests that are up to, again, 49% of your total project cost need. What that does, again, for the agency is it allows you to reduce potential costs of financing these multiple loans with the EPA because you already have a master agreement signed and executed, and the additional loan agreements will be a shorter document just with provisions of pricing and any environmental documents and classifications that we need to those individual projects. So we think it's a great purpose for the agency to utilize, and you are a great candidate with your 10-year CIP program to request this type of structure with the EPA when we enter into and hope to enter into a letter of interest with the EPA. Next slide, please. What we've shown in here on this slide is just an overview of the historic circle changes of the 30-year U.S. Treasury rate. Again, the interest rate that can be utilize on a WIFIA loan will be based on the weighted average life of the loan. But we showed here about 3 to 5 year period from 2017 through 2022 of where that U.S. Treasury rate on the 30-year maturity has been. And it from this period of time, a low has been about 1.3%, a high of almost 3.5%. So a very dramatic change month over month, year over year. But as you see, as you go towards the later parts of the final maturity of this chart, 2022, we're still looking at approximately a 3% U.S. Treasury rate. It's about 3.10 today on the 30-year maturity. So while volatile, it still provides a cheaper source of funding than long-term debt. And we'll provide you some of those credit spread differences in our analysis on the next slide. Here on slide 8 is an example of the savings that Rochelle was mentioning in the start of the presentation. What we've done is provided an estimate of potential savings for utilizing 49% WIFIA funding for a 10-year CIP. This is not a recommendation of a strategy, nor does it represent potential debt service costs the agency might incur. This is based off market conditions as of August 3rd of this year, and it assumes that were the agency to need approximately $360 million of capital improvement projects, we compared that $360 million of a 30-year bond term versus funding 49% of that $360 million, or approximately $176, utilizing WIFIA term rates and WIFIA term or WIFIA financial provisions on a 35-year term. Some of the key differences that we've shown here in our assumptions is that the bond rate for 30 years is approximately 3.9%, whereas for that same day, the WIFIA loan interest rate is approximately 3.05%. So you're seeing a cheaper source of funding from the WIFIA program, as well you're able to draw out those repayments for a longer period of time, which does overall reduce the annual payments the agency will be needed to fund through its ratepayers. The savings that could be generated, assuming this kind of structure, is almost $29 million on a net present value basis throughout the full term of these issuances. Again, I want to iterate that this is not a recommendation for a strategy, but it shows you, for an example, what type of savings can be utilized from taking this type of governmental loan program into action, assuming the agency is accepted to move forward. What we are recommending here today is to apply to the WIFIA loan program to submit a letter of interest starting and anytime after September 6th. It does not commit the agency to file or enter into any debt service obligations with EPA, but at least it provides an opportunity to accept an invitation to apply were it to be offered and allow you to potentially receive additional low-cost funding from governmental loans that would be at your disposal once you have identified the types of debt-funded projects you want to utilize going forward. That at this time concludes our initial presentation and overview of the WIFI loan program. I'm happy to answer any further questions. I'm going to open it back up to the chairman or Rochelle for any further comments.
So Rochelle, assuming you have no further comments, I'll take public comment first.
With the recommendation. Letter of interest. What the recommendation would be for the board ultimately to approve us to enter into the letter of interest with a budget of approximately $50,000. It is estimated less, but $50,000 we felt was a good number to in order to, if we had needed to engage an engineer in order to help us with the application to make our projects be fluffy, pretty, you know, whatever buzzwords that maybe the WIFI, would like to see. Also with financial advisor time and some bond counsel time. So I just wanted to let you know that there is a financial component to the letter of interest. And then of course the recommendation would be to have the finance administration committee recommend to the board to enter into the letter of interest
with you. All right, so let me go to public comment, please.
We do not have any public comment at this time.
All right, thank you. So committee comments, please.
Ed, if I can chime in real fast. We've got some heavy thunderstorms up here, and so I got cut off a few minutes ago. So if I disappear, it's not because I don't like you guys.
It's because you got struck by lightning?
Hopefully.
I'll assume you just don't like me, okay? I don't want to go to sleep tonight thinking.
All right. I'm hanging in here as long as I can. Thank you.
Did you have a comment or as well? Or
no, I just wanted you to know that if I got cut off, there was people.
It may not be that you took a direct hit.
I will say that very informative, very detailed, and great report. So thank you very much.
So before is there right if I just ask a clarifying question just so that I think for everybody's benefit, there would be nothing that prevents us from putting all of our projects back into a pot and including the ones that we intended as PAYGO and the ones that we intended to finance and stirring that pot up and then separating them out as good WIFI candidates and bad WIFI candidates. Would that be inaccurate?
Well, we could. Are you talking about adding in our PAYGO projects?
Yeah, I was just thinking that I mean, I'll make this up, but tank, Matt used, I think, the example of tank recoding. Okay, obviously we wouldn't normally want to do 30-year financing, but I mean, I choose in my personal life oftentimes maybe to finance something so that I have money for something else. And so that's kind of what I'm asking is that I'm assuming the WIFI loan, if a tank recoding was a really cool thing to the feds, that we would put that into the WIFI loan, even though internally we all know that that's not, we're going to then pay for the regional storage out of cash. If you're using that as an example.
I think we can look at both of our lists to see if there are any projects that are on our PAYGO that may qualify under the WIFI guidelines, and to see if we also want them to, try to meet that threshold of useful life of 20 to 30 years.
Well, frankly, I wouldn't care because you're generating cash that you would, And then, I had another thought, but it's gone. No other director has ever had that problem. So please go ahead.
Thank you. So I'm wondering the next step. So if we put in for the letter of interest, and there's an approximate cost of $50,000 for that, maybe less, then the next step, I'm guessing there was mentioned. Oh, first of all, thank you, Ms. Carpenter, for your presentation. I thought it was very well done, and I appreciated the detail provided. And so you mentioned that we would be invited to apply assuming we answered the questions correctly in the letter of interest. So I'm wondering what the cost component for an application is for that. So for the money we're putting out for it, I'm trying to think of the return, right? So I guess one of my questions is, how competitive do we anticipate this process to be? So how likely are we going to get the money that we decide? If there's a dollar amount that we're asking for, how likely are we to actually get that amount? And then the last question I had was, is there already perhaps some projects that we know would be really good fits for this funding source? Thank you.
So I think we were primarily looking at our debt funded project list to make sure that a majority of those, if not all, would qualify under that program. We didn't look at our PAYGO capital list, but we can definitely do that too. The application is $100,000, and that's just the application to WIFIA. And then, of course, we have our own costs for the, you know, financial advisor, bond counsel. At that time, we would probably engage an engineering firm to help us with that application process. And that amount I do not have.
So I guess I'm just trying to gauge it. How confident are we that we're going to actually not lose money on this?
I would just offer that I don't think it's out of line with other efforts we make to pursue grant funding on that side of the equation, or to do a traditional debt issuance on the other side of the equation.
Thank you.
I think these are on par or less than the kinds of costs. The leverage point for us is the potential to do a programmatic approach and get that approval for a large total amount, and then be able to bring back projects as we choose to move forward with them. That's one of the advantages I see in this approach, is at least for 49% of our funding, we're not having to necessarily issue large amounts of funding and then spend it down after we've incurred the debt. We are actually able to incur the debt as we move forward with projects at increments.
Which makes the arbitrage neutral, right?
And that's a great point provided by the general manager, is for the WIFIA loan program, if you were to draw directly from EPA, you will only be paying on the amount that you draw. And that payment amount has to be maxed out at 49% of your eligible project costs. So that is a benefit to draw only what is needed through WIFIA, whereas a bond issuance, you estimate a three-year spending need and you draw from your proceeds. And then over that three-year period, you have your funding pool of legally restricted proceeds to fund for necessary capital projects. And I think in response to Director Armitage's question, you will know quite quickly whether or not your application or your letter of interest is approved by EPA. They've committed to an 8-week turnaround time after you submit the letter of interest. And that's after submitting, of course, the upfront cost to complete the letter of interest form. So if you are invited to apply to the program, as Rochelle indicated, there will be an additional fee of $100,000. Any of those additional fees for your consultants, a bond counsel, mutual advisor, engineering firm. And lastly, there is going to be a fee to EPA for their own legal team, their underwriting team, and their consultants to finalize a master agreement and individual loan agreements. That has ranged anywhere from a minimum of $200,000 to a maximum of $350,000, $400,000. But your upfront application fee is credited towards that final payment. And due to the large CIP program the agency has, I think what Matt Stone provided is exactly correct. Your upfront payments for the letter of interest does help to maximize your needs for funding those types of long-term projects in the future, and fund those higher. They are higher than a bond issuance cost, but it does reflect also a larger portion of your CIP program.
Laura, can you describe what the analysis that you ran in order to come up with a potential savings to the customers ultimately, if it was the $360 million and the traditional bond issuance for the remaining 51% and 49% for WIFIA over the term, what would that savings be?
Happy to. So our analysis was an estimated calculation of comparing two separate scenarios, assuming the agency needed to fund $360 million over their long-term CIP, classified as the debt-funded projects. The first option was to utilize $360 million with debt financing terms, which is usually a 30-year repayment over terms and conditions and marking conditions that an agency would be able to generate in the general public market, which as of August 3rd, we estimated to be approximately 3.9%. You are then comparing that to scenario two, which is utilizing a 51% bond issuance with those same terms, but you're only funding 51% of the $360 million CIP needs, and you're actually reducing the terms, or excuse me, reducing the interest cost for 49% of that CIP because of more attractive interest rates provided by EPA, and you're able to draw out that portion of the 49% from a 30-year period to a 35-year period. All of those terms allow you to reduce your annual debt service costs in this scenario, for allowing for, in our calculations, an estimated savings of approximately $30 million through the life of the term of your bond and WIFIA loan.
Thank you.
And it would get better if we were to call that debt potentially.
Correct. That's right.
Thoughts? So it sounds like we're asking the board to commit to about a 50,000 max today, anticipating a quarter million-ish total investment if this whole project works out, and assuming that we will be using this for some level of debt in order to save the money. It sounds like that if we're able to use the program for, if we decide to use debt, this is being able to issue T-bills is a pretty good deal, which effectively is we're buying into a program where we can effectively issue T-bills ourselves-ish. So sending this to the board, I assume, not on consent. Because of the cost, I think we don't want to, we want the board to understand, and please include the 50 and the follow-on costs that potentially could be incurred if we're invited to apply and having to pay our attorneys, their attorneys.
Okay, we can add to the financial considerations what we estimate the full amount of payments to be with the letter of interest and going through the application process.
Right. Appreciate that. RJ, is that good with you? Move us to the board with our recommendation, a positive recommendation.
RJ got booted.
Okay, so hopefully he did not get struck by lightning.
Right.
But telepathically, I hear him say yes. All right. So,
will the board get the same presentation we just received?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. And so, CalPERS medical insurance.
That was sent out on Thursday as a separate attachment. Did you receive that, Director Call?
No.
Okay. I say yes. Yes. Okay. So this is would be a resolution to adjust the employer's contribution for PERS medical insurance. You may recall we discussed this about the same time last year. There were a couple things that happened at CalPERS last year, which made us change our existing resolution. And our existing resolution was based on the agency's contribution of 90% of the PERS PERS choice, PERS care plan, but PERS care plan no longer existed in 2022. They changed their plans to PERS gold and PERS platinum. So that was one of the changes that we needed to identify for our 2022 agency contributions. Well, going through that scenario, when they merged the two plans, the 90% of the PERS platinum now was significantly less than what the agency was contributing in 2021. So at that time, we had changed it to 90% of the Anthem traditional HMO. So that was the baseline. Everything that we have, all of our policies were based on 90% of the HMO. And what that did is it still, the agency would contribute a little bit more, but the employees where they typically weren't contributing were now contributing to a portion of their insurance, to their medical insurance. When we received in mid-July the new rates for CalPERS, we do our analysis because we need to put out a notice to all of our employees for open enrollment of, you know, what the plans they have to choose for and how much the employee and employer contribution would be, so they can make their best guess, you know, or what plan they want for their family and what would fit financially for them. So when we went through the analysis, we're like, oh, wow, the PERS Platinum PPO increased by 15%. So now the employees that we were comfortable with, you know, paying a smaller portion of their insurance would now be paying a significantly higher percentage. So going back, we're presenting at a staff. So, you know, we're looking back at, okay, well, what if we look back at 90% then of the PERS Platinum? And that would, which is in here, would bring up the family level to $2,322 from $2,189. I do want to note that in 2021, the agency's max contribution that was adopted was $2,424. So even by making this adjustment, we are still below our 2021 max contribution for the employer. So this analysis is just trying to, you know, letting the committee and the board know that we have 80 employees, directors, and retirees that could be affected by this higher rate and higher contribution. And it would go anywhere from the $21.36 to $243 that is their current plan to anywhere from $99 to $258 impact. And when we talk about this impact, it is just for Region 3 because our Region 3 is Los Angeles. That's where we are. So most of our analysis, since 80% of our employees, 77%, are being served by a medical plan in Region 3. So you do have a letter from a retiree that lives out of state, and the out of state retirees would have a higher impact because the medical plan is more expensive. For out of state, they don't have a choice. They can only pick one plan, which is the PERS Platinum. That's the only plan that out-of-state retirees can select. So if you look at that letter, there is some recommendations that the retiree makes, but our recommendation was to change our contribution from 90% from the Anthem traditional HMO to 90% of the PERS Platinum HMO. And we had already built in a certain percentage into the budget because we know our medical insurance does increase every year. We had a budgeted at about a $416,000 increase. By changing it to the 90% of the PPO plan, we would still be under budget by $183,000. And it would, our employer costs would go up to $78,000. So that is, we can discuss the letter from the retiree. But the staff's recommendation would be to change our existing resolution to say from 90% of the Anthem HMO to 90% of the PERS Platinum plan.
All right, so I'm going to do public comment. I think I'll take public comment from those in the audience and online first, and then I'll read the public comment I have here at my place.
Thank you. We do not have any other public comment showing at this time.
All right. So this letter is from Elizabeth Ohms. And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, if you're listening,
Graziano.
All right. Thank you. Dear Board of Directors and Administrative Committee members, my name is Elizabeth, and I was the Retail Administration Officer of the Santa Clarita Water, a division of Castaic Lake Water Agency, from June 2008 through December 2017, and then for the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency from January 2018 through May of 2020. Retired in May of 2020, and I currently live in Squim, Washington. It's interesting. My brother is building a house in Squim. That's not in the letter. I had the opportunity to review the August 9th, 2022 Finance and Administrative Committee packet proposal for changing the employer's medical insurance contributions. I understand the medical insurance premiums are increasing and the burden should be shared by both the employer and the employees. My family currently has PERS Platinum Medical Plan, which is the only plan available for out-of-state in Washington. Currently, we contribute $14.82 per month for the out-of-state PERS Platinum. The proposed 2023 agency contribution of 90% of Region 3 PERS Platinum, which would increase our monthly contribution from $14.82 to $287.48 per month. As you all know, we've had record high inflation recently, and as CalPERS retirees, we only received a 2% COLA increase, unlike active employees, which received 5.5 COLA increases. As retirees with fixed incomes, an increase of $272.66 per month is a tremendous burden and is devastating. It would not be so bad if we had other insurance options like the PERS Gold, but unfortunately, we do not have any other options other than the PERS Platinum in the state of Washington. Both my husband, Chris Graziano, and I are retirees of Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency, and when we retired, we no longer qualify for the in lieu, which was another huge loss of monthly income. Majority of participants, 80 or 33%, are currently with PERS Platinum, which will have the highest contribution impact. Eight of them are out of state. That has the highest impact since out of state premiums are higher in 2023 than in 2022 compared to Region 3. Would the Board of Directors please consider contributing 95% of Region 3 PERS Platinum instead of just 90%? This would help split the majority of the increase, 50% to the agency and 50% to the employee retirees. This would benefit both active employees and all retirees. The current proposal is showing the agency is a negative $183,303 under budget. At 95% of Region 3 PERS Platinum, it would reduce employee retirees' annual contribution by 50% from $148,450 to $74,225. The impact of the agency would be the additional $74,225. Please note that attachment 3 of committee packet is assuming all 80 PERS Platinum participants are in Region 3, which is not the case. The actual impact of most retirees would be slightly higher since Region 3 PERS Platinum has the lowest rate of $2,580.73. There are 8 out-of-state participants, 1 in Region 1, 10 in Region 2, and 61 in Region 3, as shown in Attachment 3 of the committee packet. additional PERS Platinum participants contribute contributions in 2023 above the 2022 contributions based on Region 3 only. This accounts for Attachment 3. Employee only, $77.90 per month, 18 participants, $16,826.40 per year. Employee plus one, $155.81 per month, 34 participants, $63,470.48 per year. Family, $202.54 per year, 28 participants, $68,053.44 per year. PERS Platinum Medical Premiums from Attachment 1, Region 1, I'm going to start rounding these numbers, 3,000, Region 2, 2,600, Region 3, 2,600, out of state, 2,600. Another option would be to assist only retirees or only those retirees living out of state which have no other medical insurance option other than the PERS Platinum. The last option would be to provide a replacement for the in-lieu program when the agency happens to have spouses who are both retirees of the agency. The replacement might be 25% of the current in-lieu amount which retirees can use to help pay for their medical insurance contributions. All the other options mentioned after the first one above would have a lesser monetary impact to the agency. Please consider the following options. To increase the agency's contribution from 90% to 95% of Region 3 PERS Platinum for all employees and retirees, financial impact is $74,000. To increase the agency's contribution from 90% to 95% of Region 3 PERS Platinum for all retirees only, financial impact approximately $10,000 to $15,000 since I don't have the actual retiree counts. To increase the agency's contribution from 90% to 95% of Region 3 PERS Platinum for out-of-state retirees only, financial impact less than $10,000 since I don't have the actual counts of PERS retirees Platinum categories. To provide a replacement for the in-lieu when both spouses are retirees of the agency at 25% of the current year in-lieu rate, financial impact approximately less than $5,000. I'd like to thank you in advance for your consideration of the above options to assist participants during this difficult time of high inflation, especially retirees on a fixed income. Your consideration is greatly appreciated. Elizabeth.
Michelle.
Sorry. If the 95% of the PERS Platinum, as Elizabeth had suggested in her letter, it wouldn't be 74,000, it's actually 48,650 would be the impact. We had proposed with a 90% of PERS Platinum, we would be 183,000 below our budget, and we would be 134,653 below budget by changing it to 95%.
I have a couple clarifying questions just to. So if I understand her letter correctly, basically in round numbers, she's saying that her or her husband's $2,000 benefit is, in round numbers, insufficient to pay for this. But if she's using her $2,000 benefit, his is of no value. She can't use it. It's not. Do they have the option of saying we both want individual policies for just us?
But they would probably have a similar impact because it's still based on even a single coverage would be 90% of the PERS Platinum rate for a single person. So they would still have some type of impact. It wouldn't be zero.
Okay. Well, I think that question conveys one of my concerns, but I will. Let's see. I had no public comment? Okay. Just wanted to make sure I covered that.
No other public comment.
No other public. Yes. So, committee members, please.
I'm a bit at a loss this one. I feel like it's whatever we decide, it should be for everyone. I don't think that we should have different classes, I think, as I said, it should be for everyone. So if we decide to go to 95%, it should be 95% for everyone. But I'm having some mixed feelings and still trying to wrap. I'm still confused as to why we're changing and I'm the numbers.
Go ahead, please.
So, I mean, before this letter came this afternoon, I was going to say that I'm fine with the recommendations that staff is making. I wanted to also ask to make things easier in the future, if perhaps we can change the wording of whatever, I don't know if it's a policy that we're following or whatever it is, saying that going forward, we approve 90% of whatever the highest plan is. So we're not attaching it to whatever particular plan is picked for each year. So we don't have to keep having this discussion. So I just throw that out to the committee if that's something you'd want to just discuss. In terms of her letter, I mean, I feel like all, if we're going to consider an option, I kind of like the option of replacing the in lieu amount. Help me under, well, actually, let me take a step back. Let me ask one question first is, they only have option for one insurance plan. There's no way to change that. There's no way to go back and give them options for others.
No.
Okay. That's in our rules. Okay. Okay.
It's CalPERS. That's a CalPERS rule.
Okay. So we have no control over that. Okay. Just wanted to establish that. Yeah. I mean, I feel for her. That's a lot of money. That's a big difference for people on a fixed income. So, you know, in looking at the options that she took the time to think about and suggest, I feel like if perhaps we want to consider any of them, the in lieu replacement seems to be, for me, an interesting one that I would consider and would like to talk about.
So that sort of lines up with my concern to say that two retirees have to leave one of their earned benefits on the table at zero value is dumb. It seems grossly inequitable. But none of her suggestions really suggest that or alleviate that problem. I would want to fix this problem somehow or another by saying that the second retiree's benefits can be used, you know, that basically that the two of them should have, if we're going to use this rule that you propose, they should have funds available to pay for insurance up to 180% of the plan that is available. Now, obviously, they can't get the rest back in cash, okay? But the 180%, 80% would then be left on the table and be worthless to them. That to me makes sense. That's, you know, we're saying that you've earned this benefit and you're not going to have to throw it away, and actually in almost being punished. Because if he had a different employer, he might be able to have a better plan. Who knows? So that's, I guess my question related to that is, can we suggest some language in the policy that would effectuate that, that they have up to the combined value of their two, which would be 90% times two, 180%. Is there time to do that, and could it be done?
Well, yeah, we can change the our policy with the recommendation to the board for, you know, retirees that have you know, two retirees from the agency. Question is, maybe it's not. It doesn't change anything to the existing retirees. They would still contribute because they you know, would only be one retiree and not two. There is, you know, an option still for a cash in lieu. School districts do it. You could establish a in lieu. We have our program with IGO already set up. Whatever was established, they would then get a direct deposit into their account. So that's another discussion that could be had. And it, maybe it's just a you know, a smaller amount, but it might make up the difference.
So I understand our current employees, not retirees, are eligible for cash in lieu, but you lose that eligibility upon retirement?
Yes.
And that's been a policy for a long time.
Yes.
Does it need to be changed? Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean,
well, I don't, you know, I don't necessarily agree that needs to be changed. That's kind of an ongoing, well, it's an ongoing contract for the employees that they know and understand.
Why is it? Like, why is that policy in place? Okay.
Why do we pay for health insurance at all? There's a, you know, there's really.
No, but I mean, if there's a policy for people that work here and then it changes when they retire, I'm curious why.
I looked Matt Stone's picture popped up. I thought maybe he wanted to contribute to that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough question. There are, I guess, potential inequities embedded in the way that we handle health insurance in general. As someone who is a single beneficiary for many, many years, I did the exact same work and got a lower benefit level than married employees or employees with marriage plus a family. And that's just sort of how the system works to collectively provide the funding for health insurance purchase, you know, through CalPERS and for all of the agency employees. I think that the letter does point out that upon retirement, that benefit does go away, as do other benefits like vacation and sick leave and other things. So the question is really, do we want to address that? I think it's potential thing to address. We have relatively few cases where that would be the case, but certainly could be addressed. I think the bigger question tonight is what level of funding does the committee want to recommend to the board for the larger issue, and then whether or not we want to try to address this at the same time or through a change in our overall in lieu policy, which I believe could be done separately. I'm not sure about that, Rochelle.
Yes, that can be done separately.
Matt, would you see any problem with saying that two retirees would be have available to them the combined, in this case, if this under this policy, the 90% plus 90% or 180%, which only, of course, they can only spend 100%, leaving 80% on the table.
I don't offhand know how to answer that. And I only say that because I'd like to look more into the CalPERS general rules and guidance for this. I'd be curious about, for example, the case of an employee who is retired but still has a working spouse, whether they would be able to then take in lieu payments. And I just want to make sure we don't make a implied promise in an action that would not be permissible under CalPERS rules.
So my own personal point of view would be that I would want to say that, you know, it's regardless whether you're retired or not, I would want two employees to be able to add their benefits together to get up to 100% of coverage under some particular plan. So that would be my inclination. So as it relates to that, I guess I'll ask the committee pending staff's review of the feasibility of such a thing, can we bring that forward, that part of it, as a recommendation to the board?
Yeah, I mean, I would, can we just keep them separate? Could we just approve moving forward with the recommendation for the 90% and then ask staff to continue working on this issue of the in lieu?
Yeah, that was sort of what I was going to recommend, is that we parse this into two separate conversations.
Pardon me. I'm sorry to interrupt. Our staff human resources manager would like to speak.
Please.
Ari, why don't you have a at the podium,
just
please.
Come up to
thank
the podium
you.
And yeah, we have you in person. You're
Ari, it should be on. You should just be able to speak into it.
So we're discussing about privacy, and we're discussing about environments. And Crawford is very picky when we're talking about relationships, about environment, about what you are allowed with the agency to offer to your environments. So, so we can definitely provide with and based on the policy, after we consulted with Crawford, and after we consulted with our legal counsel. So that would be one aspect of the conversation tonight. But the topic of the policy extension should be, what is the agency maximum contribution to the plans that we offer? Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I do intend to try to keep those conversations separate. That was my intent.
So, yeah. So we should definitely, because of CalPERS regulations, we should definitely keep those separately and just focus tonight on the topic of what will be the agency's maximum contribution to our monthly premiums and look at that. And then later on, we can bring up a policy change after we talk with CalPERS and after we talk with our legal counsel.
All right. Thank
would
you.
That
yeah.
be, will
yeah.
that be for?
I that was my intent, was to try to bifurcate those two conversations. That
sounds
was why
good.
I sort of tried to couch it the way I did. If we could bring that. Okay. So leaving aside the percent contribution to which plan, which I'll try to go to next. My question is, are we okay bringing you to the board or asking staff to bring to the board a recommendation to be able for two employees, retired or not, to be able to add together their available contribution to get up to 100% of whatever it is that they desire?
But the retired or the current employees, one employee would get the in lieu. So
maybe they would decide that didn't work for them. I don't know.
they're getting more money by taking the in lieu than they are by paying the copay.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand. But I would want to make it a simple rule that allows that for everyone if I had my way. So it may be that no employee would be that dumb to take it. That's fine. But a retiree would see the advantage, presumably, and add the two benefits together to get to 100%. That would be my, please.
So I guess I'm confused when you say adding benefits together. My understanding is at least, or maybe there are two different options, that for people who didn't take the insurance option, they then just get a cash value instead, right?
So the retiree doesn't have the cash in lieu option. So
right, that
so
went away
retiree.
When they retired. So I'm just saying we would just be possibly reinstating that so they could get that cash option back and then pay that difference for their
That's insurance. A different option. That's a different option. That would be a more expensive option. If we offered cash in lieu, then as somebody just mentioned, typically that's going to be a larger number, would get them something more than 100% of the Yeah. What is the cash in lieu, just in round numbers, some percentage, 50%?
No, it's the same.
It's the same as what we...
They can take the whole. They can take the whole thing. 90% of the. Oh my God, that should change. I'm sorry.
It's still cheaper though than having or providing insurance for both individuals.
Yeah, the school district incidentally gives $250 cash in lieu max, and they don't even do that for. You know, you have to be grandfathered in to get total $250.
And also the cash in lieu topic, that's another conversation.
Yeah, that's another topic. Yeah. Okay. So,
so we know.
I'm not trying to, I'm just shocked. I'm sorry that I'm sitting
that's
here.
Okay.
My teeth in my mouth.
Director
like,
Colley,
oh my God.
How about if we have staff come back to us about creative ideas for this problem instead and give them the option and they can go and they can look and see what works better. If it's cash, if it's, you know, cash in lieu, if it's giving them 180% of the benefits, whatever. I mean, basically letting them figure out what the best way to address this is, or giving us a few options so we can choose from it instead of making a decision. Like,
I think the issue there is time. We need to move forward to the next next available board meeting in order to make the timeline for this year. So. That's why I came up with a suggestion of something specific.
The item in front of you doesn't change. Those retirees that live out of state is not going to change anyway. So they would not be contributing anymore until January of 2023. So we have in between September and December in order to decide if we want to provide an additional amount to the retirees, but the only, it wouldn't change this action.
Well, it wouldn't change this act or the action that's recommended, but it might change what a retiree does in their personal life. They would make decisions based on the current policy. And so my preference would be at the next available board meeting to try to cure this problem with some direction from the committee rather than just spitballing and having staff. Now, if this doesn't work, if there's some reason that my suggestion doesn't work, then obviously it doesn't work. You tell the board that the committee came up with this idea and the law, the whatever, doesn't allow it. But I would like to at least recommend an approach from the committee rather than asking staff to bypass the committee and come up with a recommendation to the full board. We don't typically do that.
Well, since I'm not, don't know my insurance and I don't have all the policies of what happens when you retire in front of me, I think that it would be better for me to have a few options because maybe it is cash in lieu. Maybe it is something else that works better for retirees in general. I don't know. I feel like I don't like being said right now, let's solve this problem for the next meeting. It might not be the right, this might not be the right decision. And I mean, I'd like more than 5 minutes and to be able to talk to our staff.
Okay.
Personally.
I do think we would benefit from additional time. So maybe we can present it or it can be presented to the board as, you know, the 90% was approved, if that's what we decide to do. And staff is currently analyzing options for the issue, the out-of-state retirees, with looking into options around the in-lieu payment, or, you know, reinstating an in-lieu payment that would make sense. I think it warrants a little bit more discussion too.
Okay. So I think that's the, okay. So as this item, which this is odd because we are taking them in out of a logical order, at least in my head, but that's okay. So I think you're hearing that maybe the majority of the committee thinks that there is inequity here, a problem that's been identified, and we're looking for staff to come up with solutions to recommend for next month's staff meeting or committee meeting. And, we'll then revisit this.
Okay. As it pertains to
out of
retirees, two retirees from the agency.
Yes. I also want to say that this wasn't quite agendized, so I don't know how much was.
I think we're fine. This is well within the item, in my opinion. All right, but we're going to defer it anyway, so it doesn't even matter.
Do we have consensus to?
Okay, so let's go back to the staff recommendation to fund 90% of the now current highest cost policy. Okay, so I'll entertain comments on that.
I like it.
So once again, the rates are going from what to what? The employee contribution is going from, are these the numbers that
are? Yeah, so from, would have an impact.
So it's
that basically attachment three. So we'd be looking in the gray area in the middle, and where it has the 2023 HMO traditional, 2023 first platinum. This would be the employee's contribution if it was an employee rate, employee plus one, or family under the HMO traditional or the first platinum. So currently, let's look at the bottom one, first platinum family. Currently, the 90% of the HMO traditional, which is the current resolution, has an agency maximum contribution of $2,205.99. The 90% PERS platinum, which we were proposing, is $2,300 and $2,322.66. Currently, in 2022, where we are, an employee that has this plan is paying $55.53. Per month. If we keep it, the resolution the same in 2023 at 90% of the HMO traditional, that same employee will contribute $374.74. If we change it to 90% of the PERS platinum, that same employee would contribute $258.07. So even by changing it to the higher rate plan, employees will 80 employees that have the PERS platinum will see at least with a family plan an increase of $202.54 per month. So this was,
kind of
staff
expensive.
Is advocating for staff, and staff is currently contributing at the $55. They're going to now contribute $374. So we're looking at the plan that's like, oh well, maybe we should go back to the PERS PPO that we had the prior year. Maybe that's the better policy choice. So this is our attempt to present the two options. You'll see what the employee contribution is if we keep the resolution the same, and what the employee contribution would be if we change it.
Also, let me tell you who has that plan, because I know the employees better than anyone. These 80 employees are not picking this plan because they want the most expensive plan. Absolutely. Nobody will not wants to contribute to the insurance that much money. They're employees who really have needs to have this plan. We have, I cannot name employees, of course, or anything, but we have, I know, like three or four employees who have special needs children. So I think there's at least about 10 or 11 children of our organization, employees, who have needs, who need this kind of plan to go to developmental pediatricians, who they need to see specialists and doctors within a network that is more larger than your regular HMO or your regular other PPO plans. So those are the type of employees who really have the need for this plan. Not because they want to pick the most expensive plan, and not because they want to contribute so much to their monthly payments. So these are really employees. We already have a medical condition themselves. The employees suffer from something medically that they do need to go see the specialist every month and get treatments. So those are the kinds of employees who pick that plan. So just to let you know, since I know them better. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my point, that this is going up a lot. And I personally would like to split. Personally, I feel like we should split it with them and do the 95%. I know you're not a fan of that, but.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't see that one coming. To go to 95% of them. So, all right. I will chime in here. What happens here is we're continuously ratcheting up, and a ratchet is, and I use that term pretty specifically, not just increasing, but we are constantly picking the highest plan and saying that, you know, that's our new cap and, you know, 90% of that one. And so every year we go to the highest plan, which ratchets, it captures that, that new high, and effectively we write it into our policy. I'm an advocate of setting a number that we're comfortable paying. The number would be less. I'm also not an advocate of saying that, as the general manager pointed out, somebody who does the exact same work gets less benefit. Because they didn't happen to decide to marry or have children or whatever. My inclination, if I was the only one on the board, would be to set a number, and that would be the agency's willingness to contribute to your health insurance, and that would be all. But I obviously have, you know, I've talked about that before with the entire board. I obviously have not made any progress towards my desire. I merely say that it is. And I think I'm hoping that we're not going to recommend to go to 95% of the most expensive and at least keep it at 90% as the recommendation of this committee. I'm looking at you because you're going to be the...
Listen, healthcare in general is extortion. It really is. Yeah. I mean, the fact that having to pay, I mean, then there's co-pays, then there's this, then there's that. There's so much that goes into it. And someone that was paying $55 beforehand now has to pay $258. That's a lot of money on a monthly basis with everything else. And I think that we get what we pay for, too. I think that retaining our employees and keeping them happy is important.
I would point out in comparison that we offer, I think the federal government used the term Cadillac programs. This is more Ferrari. This is way beyond Cadillac. What we offer our employees is already unbelievably generous. There are few public agencies that, you know, nationwide that offer this kind of
I hear benefit. I hear you on that. I just, at the same time, I think it's a sad day that this is considered Cadillac, and I'm sure that there are Ferrari. And, you know, I'm still sure that there's things that people can't do with this. So,
so I'll chime in. So it seems like, you know, we're seeing, comparing the cost from last year to this year, that the market changes, right, for insurance costs. So we're having to chase the market around. And so what we're seeing, if we go with what's recommended, is that, you know, we'll pay up to 90% of the highest cost of whatever insurances are offered to the employees. I was actually surprised that last year it was an HMO, because knowing what I know about the insurance industry, that those are actually less options to patients in an HMO plan than there is in a PPO plan. So I was really surprised, and I had to ask Ms. Patterson, why is the HMO the highest cost one? So it's interesting to see it go back to PPO, which actually makes more sense to me. I don't think we should go with the dollar amount. I think going with the percentage is better. I'm confident that the recommendations set by staff meet the needs of the employees, and I'm assuming they like that type of plan. You were telling us that, you know, there are employees that have special circumstances that the plan seems to meet. I'm comfortable with going with the recommendation, so I'll be kind of middle ground. We're not going to go with the dollar amount. I would love to go with Director Bronstein and say 95%, but I feel like going with staff recommendation is my happy middle ground.
So I think we can say that the committee by consensus recommended the staff recommendation. Are we okay with that? All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions for me? Do you need me up here? Am I in trouble now?
Okay. I doubt you're out of trouble.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank
of
you.
Course. And we'll look into the policy for retirees. So.
All right. And that'll come up. You'll come back to the committee next month.
Yeah.
All right. And I would hope that that staff would reach out to our public commenter and tell her that maybe what you heard today.
Yes.
Yeah, that we recognize her pain. All right. So, Chris.
Yes.
You finally get to speak.
There we go.
So we're on the technology update by Chris Perez here.
Right, a little change of pace, larger font, less bullets points. So thank you again, FNA committee, for allowing me the opportunity to provide you guys with a quarterly update. If you think back, if you were here last quarter, my theme or my I started off the presentation with just saying that, you know, good or bad, everything's connected to the internet. I was thinking about that same concept applies to what I'm talking about today as well. So I wanted to share that. Some folks weren't at that last quarter committee. So again, this is just an informational update. Yeah. There are people for sure. That wouldn't be a good sign. That wouldn't be a good sign at all. Great. Could you move on to this next slide, please? I'm sorry, back one. I think we jumped. There you go. There you go, right there. So what you're looking at there, I wanted to kick it off. What you're looking at there on the screen in front of y'all is the a new tech services logo we put together. And the idea behind this was to, number one, is to represent the different disciplines we have in tech services. The globe you see there is for our GIS. The gear or cog there is for our SCADA, or I'm also calling it operational technology. The mouse is for traditional IT. And then the shield and lock, of course, is for cybersecurity. And we came up with this because we do a lot of messaging in the organization. More than anyone, we're blasting everyone with emails about the latest and greatest cyber hack that's going on, or reminding you about training. Letting you know about letting the staffers know about the patching that's happening overnight, et cetera. So there's a lot of communication. And the thought is here that once you open up the email or that notification, you already know it's the tech services and this is legit. And you click on or you open up whatever's being shared. So next slide, please. Great. So I want to share a couple kind of department-wide projects we're working on, just real quickly, some updates on what we're up to project-wide. And then I'm going to go into the various disciplines I just mentioned. We'll talk about GIS real quick, and we'll talk about some of the stuff that the IT is working on, some of the stuff that cybersecurity is working on, et cetera. So we'll go through all that, and I'll finish up with a new thing that's happening in our tech services department. I'll share some stuff about SCADA. A lot of folks, I'm assuming, have been exposed to that. If you haven't been in the water industry a long time, you probably haven't come across that word, possibly, but I'll go into the details later on in my presentation. So here we have listed a couple, four big projects that are hitting the agency. These are led by the tech services department, but there's collaboration with other various departments. The first one is the microwave upgrade. So we have a microwave system here at Rio Vista that moves data from here over to Earl Schmidt and back again. It goes back and forth. And what it helps provide is some redundancy and the ability to move data, like physical data and trends and whatnot, back and forth, and have both backups and redundancy of operations. So with that, that project I went out to RFP a couple months back, and we had no bids. So we kind of came up with some creative ideas, went back to the drawing board, and we're going back out to bid later this week, if not early next week. And I'll be bringing this to this committee for hopefully, crossing my fingers, for an approval for an approval in next month. And I'll give you some more detail what's involved in that microwave project at that point in time. Secondly, here I've listed is a security camera project, and this is all our legacy organizations had all their own technologies in regards to security cameras. A lot of them are vintage now at this point in time. And we're in the process of it's a big project to consolidate and find the technology that best fits our agency and our needs, and then install it across the board. And so this project here is involved the Buildings and Grounds Department, the operations and treatment folks, tech services, of course, and then we've also brought in the Sheriff's Department. They've been helping out and giving their thoughts and experiences in that regard. Right now in that project, just high level, we've done walkthroughs of all our facilities along with the Sheriff's Department. We've kind of documented all the criteria we're after, what we want, what's going to be best serving this agency. And then where we're at right now is we're coordinating kind of one-on-ones with various other agencies, so similar organizations to folks that have already implemented newer technologies, and we're trying to get a lessons learned so we can get the benefit of some other organizations already, their trials and tribulations with some new technology of camera or whatnot. So that's happening now. So I know certain directors have asked about that that project, and that's where we're at right now. Moving on to the VPN and MFA. So VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. MFA stands for Multi-Factor Authentication. So we have implemented half of that. So we're completely done with the MFA implementation. A couple months back, you might have remembered one of our directors had shared, talked about kind of a trend they've seen, I guess, from the insurance side of things, cybersecurity. Now, there's a requirement now at the bare minimum that you have MFA installed. Our president had a directive as of last year. All federal agencies had to have by November of last year MFA in place, and federal agencies are still way behind. But I'm happy to share that we have implemented that. We have multi-factor authentication both on our SCADA systems as well as our business networks, and that's complete. The other half of that's what's called a virtual private network. And that's we have one we've used as an agency, but we're shifting and pivoting to a more functional, more flexible system that will help and protect our resources when they're outside the office. Then lastly, there one of the last big projects we want to share there, and that's it seems like it's a constant iteration of our SharePoint. SharePoint is a company intranet. It's where we all go to, find a document that we need from HR, or we need a set of plans from engineering. So right now we're in the process. We during the COVID, right before COVID, we were pushing out. We had developed this beautiful SharePoint. We push it out, and then as the whole agency shifted and adjusted our workflows, we now have to adapt and make this fit what modern day work is nowadays. So we're working right now with integrations with the interactive maps. We're also working on dashboards that will show agency employees on a daily basis when we get there, you know, how many meters were replaced that day, or how many hydrants were flushed that week, et cetera. All that data will live inside this our agency intranet. So next slide, please. So the disciplines. So starting off with GIS, I just want to share in advance here. There's a nice little graphic up in the right corner. I shared this 4 years ago when we installed them. So our GIS folks are responsible for the GPS technologies that we use in this agency. So GPS is Global Positioning Systems. And what we have is survey grade data capture. And that's unique because a lot of other water agencies, they would use what they call it mapping grade technology. So they were good enough with plus or minus 10 feet. And we here at this agency, we early adopted, before we even merged together, we already adopted the concept of survey grade data collection. Because the idea there is you can collect the data point once and it's good forever. Having a point that's less than a couple centimeters in accuracy is good enough. We're never going to get to that molecular, maybe we will, who knows, molecular level. But centimeter accuracy, X, Y, and two times centimeter accuracy at elevation is what we have now. So with that, what I'm showing there in the right corner there is those are our medallions or our survey control points. We have 9 of these that we put out throughout the valley. And when our GIS folks go out to collect data points, for example, right now they're working really closely with water resources because of some drought related initiatives, and they're capturing X, Y, and Z's of all our water wells. So what they do is they go out, they check into the closest monument, Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency Monument, and then they go out and collect the data point and then check out at that point. So I want to share that again. I think we're really proud of that. We did that 4 years ago, and it was because we're servicing the entire valley now. And so we strategically placed those throughout the valley, and they get little recognition because only those who know. So I wanted to share that. So like I said, GIS is really involved in cross-departmental efforts, helping out the Water Resources Department. And then on a day-to-day basis, they're in the trenches moving data and maps and support documents to all of the field staff through what's called a kind of a field applet, which the folks out in the field have like their iPad or their iPhone, and they're able to access documents and as-builts and water plans throughout those devices. And to keep that up to date, our staff is constantly working to bring in the changes and modifying and making red lines and updates. So it's constantly being changed and updated. Next slide, please. Sure, yes. More than happy.
Sorry, yes, please. Do we have folks out in the field mapping three-dimensional placement of facilities before they get buried and that sort of thing?
We're getting that better at that. You know, I know the COVID kind of threw a little rhythm out, but we're getting better at that. I think when we started, we had a workflow that included that. So there was, again, it's the availability of someone to go out there and capture that point. And then if we didn't have that, there were also contractors and subcontractors that would follow our procedures to collect that data as well. But it's a work in progress. And I don't think it's 100% there yet, but it's a dream of mine to be able to build a three-dimensional water system with accuracy, and we're working towards that.
I would think that someday that we're going to need less potholing and that sort of thing because we're smart enough to.
Exactly. That's exactly right. The point. The technology is not quite there yet to reproduce that. I was in I'm just sharing too much information, but I was in an innovation work group a couple of years ago. And what was amazing coming out of MIT was that very thought, is that we're developing a model, a water model, so that in the future, you know, someone can bring an out, you know, for example, of an iPad and see what's under the ground with accuracy. And that's where we're getting. It's not quite there yet, but that's the future. So instead of potholing and digging up the ground, you have all this data, X, Y, and Z, that, you know, that now can display exactly where that pipe falls out in the real world. And then again, it saves tons and tons of money on potholing and those types of exercises. So that's the future. You're welcome. Next slide. IT. So IT, our traditional IT folks, so computers and phones and all that stuff. So IT has been focused recently but it's been a huge, humongous effort. And we're trying to migrate all our systems and all our stuff into what's a computer management system. So you can imagine we have hundreds and hundreds of devices, iPads and iPhones and workstations and laptops. And we came up with a naming convention and a strategy to connect the dots between each individual asset and our management system. So we know what patches that device needs. We know where that device is. We know all this information about the device. So with that, we're in the process of now labeling each individual device, so that the folks are taking these. There's this picture of that label there. So now we have to touch every single device in this organization. It's easier once we get caught up. You know, once, you know, the one-offs we do on a daily basis isn't that bad. It's getting caught up with all hundreds and hundreds we have right now. So that's a work in progress. We're going to be physically labeling all those assets with this tag that you see before you. It's connected to a QR code. Again, overall, this will help with the overall patching and management of those devices, but also just the deployment and then the retirement of those devices as well. Next slide, please. Cybersecurity. So the focus in cybersecurity right now is training and education. And I'm not sure if you guys, you know, I think in my Twitter feed, I keep saying it over and over again, but Google has been like advertising the heck out of their upgraded security features in Gmail. So anybody who's used Gmail, I think Google's been hyping up their phishing blocking. So what the ad says, I've seen this ad like 30 times now. What the ad says, Google tells you 90% of cybersecurity attacks start with phishing and bad clicks. So with that said, our focus is education. So right on this graphic here, we have, I pasted where we're at training wise. We've implemented a strategic training effort. We have monthly kind of focused trainings on particular topics, and they're only 5 minutes. So some folks in this organization remember once upon a time, we had like a 45 to an hour training once a year. And it's like pulling teeth trying to get everyone sitting down for a 1 hour training once a year. But what's we've gotten a lot of positive feedback on these short 5 minute trainings, and they're interactive and they're entertaining for those of you seen them. But right now our training completion's at 75%. We've identified our struggling group that we need to kind of capture. And we have some ideas and strategies that we're going to carry out. So next time, hopefully, I when I meet with you all again, I'll have a better number there. And then secondly, there's another big number listed there. It says fish prone. That's phishing prone. So we use another system, which we use to create fake phishing. So what we do is we send out this phishing campaign to see how many of every 100 fake phishing that goes out is clicked. So what that says right there, 1.7, means that more or less almost 2 people for every 100 is clicking on a bad thing, which is awesome. It's a good number, and we've got to work really hard to stay at that number, because the industry standard for government organizations at our size and our maturity is 3.9%. So we're doing pretty good, but that's going to continually take work to keep up at that level. The next slide, please. Then lastly, this is the final finale here, is OT. I call it OT, operational technology. It fits. And for those who don't know, it is SCADA. So SCADA stands for supervisory control and data acquisition. It's a term not a lot of folks know. And, you know, people even know that know that acronym and what it stands for still don't know what it does. But so what SCADA is it's a combination of like hardware and software that that allows us to monitor and control industrial processes. So in our business, our industrial process in water is like pumps and boosters and analyzers and all those field machines, field apparatuses. And that's what SCADA does. It helps us control all that stuff that's out there, the tanks and the moving of the water and the treatment plant and the adding of chlorine and the adding of other chemicals. All that's controlled through the SCADA networks. And why was SCADA moved into tech services? So once upon a time, this is before everything was connected to the internet. SCADA was kind of a one and done. You know, this is the old school mentality that you built a SCADA system to run your treatment plant or to run your water system. And you let it, okay, it's done. We built it. We're good for 10 years. Don't touch it. We're good. And as the world evolved, and now that my refrigerator is connected to the internet, SCADA now has to kind of keep up with the Joneses. It has to keep up. It has to be updated and patched. It has to, it's not too dissimilar now to a natural business network. And further downstream, things get closer and closer and closer and similar to a bit natural business network. So the idea was to bring SCADA into tech services now that we kind of follow the same timeline, so to speak. We're discussing issues on a weekly basis, just like our business network, discussing cybersecurity issues on a weekly basis for the business network. We're now having those similar conversations for the SCADA systems and SCADA updates and patching and all that. Also here listed is the distribution and treatment. So we have one SCADA person, and we're very lucky to have this person. His name is James Woodall. We're very lucky to have him. He was a consultant contractor for all the legacy organizations in this valley. So before we all merged together, this gentleman worked for a contractor out of Bakersfield and helped us upkeep and service all our systems. So this gentleman, we were lucky enough to bring him over from the private sector. They had hired him right when we merged, and he's been critically important to the success of what's going on in SCADA. And he's the one that he consolidated all the legacy water distribution systems into one SCADA system over the course of the last 4 years. And now he's getting involved in the treatment plant, and he's going to help consolidate those systems. And then what the value of this is as well is that there's a lot of data that comes out of SCADA, and operators on a daily basis use that they trend data to make adjust set points and to take actions. But this data can now also feed into our water modeling processes, into our engineering, into supporting the master plan endeavor we're heading into. So there's a lot of data here that now can be funneled into other systems and integrated. And again, part of that consolidation in the distribution and treatment will help us unsilo a lot of that data and feed it into a lot of our applications and a lot of our business processes. The graphic below, I try to make it super, super simple. The graphic below just kind of shows you what SCADA is. So there's a Windows, there's a Windows graphic there, which is Windows computer. All the computers we use are everything's Windows based. Then the little gear represents a SCADA software. So SCADA software lives on those Windows computers, that Windows network. Then the next graphic there is a PLC, that's a programmable logic controller. And that controller is the smarts between the physical device. I put a pump there on the right side. So it can be any physical device, but that's the connection. The physical device goes to a PLC, which goes into the SCADA software, which feeds in, lives in the Windows environment, and the data goes back and forth. So I push a button in SCADA, goes to the PLC, turns on the pump, pump turns off, goes to the PLC, comes back into the SCADA environment, and vice versa. So that's just simply just a graphic that gives you a sense of how it all works. So. Well, that concludes my slides and my update. I'm happy to answer any questions.
So we'll first take any public comment.
We do not have any public comment at this time.
All right. So committee members, questions, comments?
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Are we still getting our monthlies? We were getting monthly security
trainings.
I haven't seen it in a while. Is it because a month?
They're every 45 days right
every
now.
45 days. Okay. I thought it was like every month.
So let me share is so it was supposed to come out last. It's a good catch. It was supposed to come out last week.
Okay.
And so one of the communication strategies we're tweaking is we're going to take advantage of that interaction, you know, of that email we send out. We're going to start putting in more information in that email so we can get get a little more education in your way. So when you read the email, before you click the button to go to your training, there'll be additional tidbits of like success stories and stuff like that. So
read the email.
read the new email. It's going to be coming out I think tomorrow.
Just say, please read me.
There's a lot of traffic to compete with. So good catch.
Thank you for your presentation. Just a few comments. Cool logo. I like that. I love the collaboration that you're doing with other agencies, including the Sheriff's Department. When you were telling us about the medallion, I was just thinking in my head, I'm like, we need like a cool geocaching game where people can go and find them. I used to do geocaching with my kids years ago. It was super fun. In terms of cybersecurity, I think the training videos they're fun. They're quick and entertaining, and you have to take a quiz, so you have to pay attention. And I think they're great. So kudos to you all. The 1.7% Fish Pro number, that's awesome. I think that speaks to your efforts. So good job on that. I mean, I think cybersecurity is probably, in my opinion, one of the most important things that your department does. You know, you keep hearing those horror stories out there of what's the vulnerabilities that some agencies have. And so I very much appreciate the attention that is given here at this agency to cybersecurity, and ask you to please continue doing that. And then I think that's it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Just out of curiosity, is RJ back, or is he on his way to the emergency room? Or
I have not seen him reappear or hop off.
I hope he survived the lightning strike. All right. I think. Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
We appreciate it. And I think we're moving on to Jesus Ramirez. Welcome.
Right. So, you know, we're quarterly, we're going to be seeing Chris and Jesus to give us some type of tidbits for updates. And since we were reporting on our fourth quarter, this is the time. So that's why you're seeing both Chris and Jesus here today. Right.
Well, both of them had to sit through. So we apologize.
No problem.
Sorry.
It's very informational. Thank you.
Good lie. Good. Appreciate
all right.
That.
So good evening, committee members, staff, and members of the public. Tonight we have a quick presentation to serve as an informational item on some of our initiatives that we're doing so that you're aware of them, but also to so we can provide you updates on why we're doing them, as well as give you kind of just an overview of other requests that you'll be seeing in the future. So next slide, please. Let's see. That doesn't seem like the right one. So while we wait for this light, I'll talk a little bit about it. So there's really, the state has set very ambitious goals to transition to zero emissions on the transportation sector. So I think for our purpose, right, at a very high level, we have to assume that everything will have to transition to zero emissions at one point or another. So we know that that's the path that the state is taking. So we're preparing for that through a series of short-term as well as long-term strategies and initiatives that we're doing, both as a matter of regulatory compliance, but also just as a operational practice, right? Being responsible stewards of natural resources as being part of our strategic plan. So again, we have a couple of long-term and short-term initiatives. So as far as the timeline, For fleet and warehousing, we're looking at piloting vehicles in 2022, as well as completing site assessments of our facilities. So we have vehicles at all of our facilities, so we need to be able to support that transition for those vehicles. A big part of that is looking at what's the infrastructure that's already in place, as well as looking at what needs to be upgraded through Edison, as well as through our facilities as well, to be able to support that transition. In 2023, we anticipate going into infrastructure build outs and capital improvement projects for charging infrastructure, right? It's not only the vehicles, but it's also building out that charging infrastructure. As we look into 2024 to 2030, we're going to be looking at the rollout of zero emission vehicles throughout our operations. And again, in the future, you'll be seeing some future considerations, possibly for additional funding for the infrastructure as well as for the vehicles. And we're also going to be looking at different strategies of how to be able to facilitate that, including vehicle leases. So one of our long-term solutions is really to right-size, standardize, and modernize our existing vehicles, right? Every time we're looking at replacing a vehicle, we ask those questions: is this the right vehicle for this duty, right? Can we go to a smaller vehicle that's more fuel efficient? Or is there a way that we can do our job duties in a more efficient way? So again, we're looking at that through either vehicle replacements or vehicle reassignments. As you know, getting vehicles right now is very difficult. So we're looking at our existing resources and looking at who has what type of vehicles, right? And whether we can reassign them throughout the agency to somebody that can better utilize those bigger vehicles that actually need a towing capacity or need to be able to carry large payloads. Next, we have our, we're on slide five. There we go. So again, as we're looking at deploying electric vehicles, right now we're in that phase where we are piloting vehicles in non-essential assignments, right? So we received the delivery of our first vehicle. So thank you to Chris and his staff for volunteering to be the first department to pilot that vehicle. It is an electric van. And it's really designed so that we can gather real-world data, right? There's data that the manufacturers release as far as the range and what you're actually going to be able to do. However, all of that varies based on your location, the geography, temperature, and then the assignment, and also very importantly on the driver. So again, as we mentioned during the conversation of telematics, that was a big part of that, right? Is to capture those data points as well as complete feasibility studies. So with these pilot vehicles, right, we know that it is a possibility that some of them may fail, right, the assignments that are assigned. So that's why we went through the lease route. We don't want to purchase these vehicles outright because it's the first generation, right? You don't want to get stuck with that first generation and be like buying an iPhone, right, first generation. You don't want to have that for 10 years. So with the lease, we're able to get this first generation, learn important lessons, and then also replace it with a newer vehicle in 2-3 years down the line that has better range. So next slide, please. Again, as I've mentioned, we're going to be looking at deploying infrastructure. So the big part of that is completing those site assessments. It's also, as we look at deploying, right, a big part of that is how do we design infrastructure that's disaster resilient. And a big portion of that is going to include battery storage so that if there is a power outage, which we know do happen and they're continuing to increase, that we're able to still function during those situations. There's large costs associated, right, with transitioning, both for the vehicles themselves, but for the infrastructure. There's large upfront costs. So we're going to be looking at using grants as well as utilizing low carbon fuel credits, as well as renewable energy credits from our solar assets to be able to offset some of those initial costs. And a big part of that is going to be also implementing a load management solution. So because we're in California, depending on what time you charge, your electricity can be cheaper than gas or diesel. It could also be more expensive. So because we're going to have large number of vehicles charging at the same time, that means that our bills can go up really substantial unless we manage when we charge and how we charge. So that's going to be a big part of that. Next slide, please. also other short-term solutions we're looking at. We know that the transition is not going to happen overnight, but there are things that we can do now to be more sustainable while minimizing impact to operations. So we've been using renewable diesel, which is chemically indistinguishable from petroleum diesel, in our operations with little or no impact to our operations. It's also a much cleaner fuel. So with the use of this, we can reduce emissions by up to 80% on our older and also our off-road equipment that doesn't have a lot of emission controls like filters. So that's what we've been doing. So as you can see, that's just an example of renewable diesel versus petroleum diesel. It's cleaner. So we also have less maintenance issues because as you can see, it burns less soot, which clogs up the filters. Next slide, please. One other initiative we've been doing is we've been recalibrating some of our vehicles as part of a pilot program. So if you've driven newer vehicles, they tend to already come with automatic stop and start technology, right? If you're at a light, the engine will shut off to save on fuel and it will start as soon as you let go of the brake. So that's with newer vehicles. So it's the same concept with existing vehicles. What you do is you reduce the rate that the vehicle idles. And that's what you could see on the top picture. It's essentially just reducing that rate. And based on that, you can have fuel savings as well as emission savings. So the results that we saw, we had 14 vehicles that got recalibrated. We had a control group to account for changes in temperature, drivers, and all those things. And we saw an improvement of about 8.25% on MPGs. So when you extrapolate that, that's about $600 in savings of fuel per year per vehicle. And then also it's almost a metric ton of CO2 that we would save per vehicle as well. So that was the results of our pilot, and we're looking to expand that going forward as well. There was some limited impact to operations as far as, changing the way that the vehicle accelerates. So we got to do some small changes there, but we'll be able to deploy that to a larger portion of the fleet. And then again, a metric ton, it's the bottom photo that shows you a visual of what that actually looks like, which is, roughly the size of a house. So to kind of put that into perspective, that's what that looks like. Next slide, please. So that concludes the presentation. So I'll take any questions that you guys have.
All right. We're first going to go to public comment, as always.
No public comment at this time.
All right. So committee members, please. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I love how on top of everything you are. It seems like it's very well organized, well thought through. That's great. I was wondering if we're going to be able to produce enough renewable energy to, charge these beautiful zero emission vehicles.
No, we won't. Unfortunately, right, because of the high demand of electricity just for the water systems, that doesn't account for that. So, but we'll be able to offset some of those costs through a combination of the renewable energy credits from solar, but then also from the fuel, right? So that when you're charging, you're offsetting, X amount of gallons. But unfortunately, we won't be able to get to that point.
Yeah, thank
good
you.
Question, though.
Unless we build a devil's den, then and we will.
I was thinking that.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm glad to see the alignment with the state's efforts to reduce emissions, and it sounds like this fits really nicely into the sustainability plan as well, from what I've heard. Let's see. A couple questions. One is there a plan to have all sites have the electric vehicle charging stations eventually?
Yeah, so the plan will be to use what they call depot charging, right? So it's designing that infrastructure to be able to support the vehicles when they come at the end of their shift so that they can charge overnight. So wherever that vehicle is located at the end of the day, that's ideally where you would design that charging infrastructure. So we'd be looking at our main facilities, Rio here, Rockefeller, Pine, as well as Golden Triangle.
Okay, thanks. And then I was wondering about the cost comparison between the renewable diesel and the petroleum diesel.
They're on par. There's subsidies that the state has that pretty much make it on par. So
that's interesting. That's really cool. That was my last question. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. We good? Oh, go.
I have one other quick question. I wanted to know how IT was dealing with it and how many times did they get stuck or if they didn't get stuck.
I'm still waiting for that call. But so far as I know that they've been okay. Yeah. And that is something part of the emergency plan, right? For a traditional vehicle, right? You have your 5-gallon right container that you can fuel up, right, and take it there. So we are looking at that where we'll have to have some sort of battery packs that we can take to the facility or where that vehicle is located to give them enough power to get make it back to the yard or to the next charging station. So that is part of that infrastructure. So good question.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you in 3 months.
All right. Thanks.
All right. All right, so receiving and filing fourth quarter in the June 2022. Can I go straight to public comment, or do you have any specific things you want to highlight? Okay. Did you detect that?
Rochelle.
We did add on page 211. It's a three month cash flow projection, and we hadn't had this before. It is a tool that with our new Oracle system, our finance people, Darreen and Kim, were able to put together with a consultant in order to just hit a button. And the only thing we have to do is manually put in our beginning balance, and then it pulls all the budget information. We do go through it and add any cash that we think is going to be expense that may be outside the budget for that particular month. But it's just a tool, just another tool for us to go down and look for 3 months and say, okay, we're still doing good. but it's just something that has been added to the packet.
All right, let me go to public comment if there is any.
We do not have any. This is item 9, yes?
Yes, item 9.
We do have public comment from right. In person this evening, Cam Noldmeyer.
All right, Cam. Go ahead.
Having watched what's been going on with this, till soon we will have an election, and that's only a couple months away. So things will change drastically. But on the Treasurer and Administrative Committee, I was curious about, and I love looking at financial things. And this is the PAYGO project list. And I was wondering, because I saw Devil's Den Property Solar Project. Now I thought, gee, that came up rather quickly since we just recently had a meeting on them. And it's in two other counties. It has nothing to do with our area at all. This is how crazy things have gotten. And they're proposing, they already said $100,000 for them. $100,000. Devil's Den Property Solar Project. So in two counties, no connection with ours, they are planning a solar project. Now, I wonder how much, you probably can tell us, how much the solar project and who's going to benefit from the solar project. Are you going to find some way to bring the results of that solar project down here? It's these things I have been following for years and years. And like I said, we are going to have an election in a couple of months, and then it will be interesting to see if some of these corrections like this can be done away with, and we can get our local people being considered, because you're under a lot of debt, and we're going to have to pay for that. And we're going to have to get people in there that will see what they are, would stick to the job at hand of what they are doing. And a lot of things come up, like they did on this agenda too, that get a lot of attention. But the important things are not getting attention. I have missed them consistently. I have been to every single meeting. And I used to do this type of thing. That was my career. And I've been looking at this agency, as you probably know, show up at every meeting. And there are problems. And those
thank
problems
you. This completes your correct. 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I was trying to figure out how that related to anything that we were discussing, but
I have a question.
Yeah, the idea that we can make money on a Devil's Den solar project and bring the cash into this agency is, I don't know, I still think it's a good idea. Go ahead.
I'm going to ask you about the water sales. And do we know if it's because of conservation? I'm guessing it's because of conservation. And I was wondering if we had July's numbers yet.
We do not. We checked today, and the July usage hasn't, and the revenue hasn't been posted yet.
Okay.
So we are seeing in the last quarter a dip in our revenue and our usage, as expected, after, you know, our call of our conservation efforts and education. But we don't know yet the impact yet for July.
Are we going to adjust our next forecast based on...
Well, we'll still keep the forecast because it does have some conservation built into it, and we'll just continue to track it. We did identify it in our pro forma if we did need to use some of our available cash to offset that revenue loss, that we could do that. And we anticipated it could be upwards of $8 million if it was a full year of an additional 15% conservation.
Yeah, because we're kind of pushing that right now, and we're hoping that it takes. So yes. I hope that we're adjusting for that too. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Next up is the committee planning. Oh, sorry. Did I?
I didn't have questions. Thank you.
Okay. It's with, yeah, well, I'm supposed to look left and right, and it's, yeah, my poor neck is just, all right. So committee planning calendar, I want to check and see if there's any public comment on that.
No public comment at this time.
And we will be, adding in some scenario analysis for, debt PAYGO yeah. rates.
Okay.
To that. We also have an item to add for discussion, the agency's, holidays. It was brought up to review our holidays. So HR did perform a questionnaire and a survey, and we will bring the results back in September. So I wanted to let you know that your request did not go unheard. And those were the additions to the planning calendar.
All right. And then future agenda items. I'm first going to ask for public comments on that before I ask for the committee.
No public comment at this time.
All right. Future agenda items from the committee. Go ahead, please.
I am wondering if when there is space and time, we could get an overview of the hiring process, right? Would that be appropriate for this committee?
Sure.
Okay. So, I mean, I feel like I don't have a good understanding of the process from the beginning to end. So when a position opens up, where does it get advertised? How do people apply? What does the application look like? What's the selection process like? All of that, I feel like, I mean, I can guess what it's like, but I don't really know for sure. And I think it would be nice information to have as a board member.
I might suggest also, before we jump straight to the process, we should review what the board's policy is that guides the process.
Sounds good.
Yes, we do have a employee policy for recruitment. So we can pull that up, but maybe there's some details of where, how many places we advertise that we could add for your benefit. I'm just wondering if this would just be a, for you, just a discussion for the committee. There wouldn't be any action, so that's why I'm just asking.
I mean, when I watch some of the other committees, like engineering and operations, they always have a fun little educational component that they throw in at the end that I think is really cool. So I guess I'm asking for something like that on the administrative side.
Okay.
I don't know how fun we are. Well, here's the thing. If nobody else is interested, okay. Director Bronstein's raising her hand. Because I was going to say, if no one else is interested, then I can just do it one-on-one with you.
No, I said I'm interested too in hearing.
It seems like a legitimate, I would, let's try not to put it on a night with a heavy agenda, although I think your ability to project heavy agendas is limited.
And you are fun.
All right. Anything else? All right. Thank you. So you remember the famous maintenance moments from Newhall. So I think that's what you're being asked for is
I brought in Chris and
there's other people with beards that are even more entertaining, believe it or not, than you are. Dr. PFAS. Or Captain PFAS, sorry. So item 12, general report, Rochelle.
You know, I think we have hit just about everything tonight.
Oh, come on. It's only, you can surely come up with something. All right. Do we have any public comment on the non-report?
Oh, nope. I'm sorry. Oh. I did. I have two things.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just real quick, I had mentioned last month that I would report on what our AR, our accounts receivable balance was through COVID, after COVID, and after we received the money through the state for the arrearage program. The first thing was just a report on SB 114. That was the COVID relief. That is set to expire on September 30th of 2022. In January of 2022 through July of 2022 this year, 94 employees have used that COVID leave for a total of 3,142 hours and a cost of about $142,000. That was primarily due to this last very contagious variant that we have. We have had quite a few cases. Comparing it to 2021, there were 3,296 hours used. About 76 employees used those hours. About 20% of those were for vaccine recovery because the policy did allow for that. So that's just a couple things on the COVID policy and that it is currently set to expire unless the state or the board chooses differently. And then on the AR summary, we currently have $624,255 that is outstanding. $156,000 is in that period of 46 to 70 days. $468,000 is greater than 70 days. Now, if we can compare it back to February of 2020, right before COVID, we were running about $345,000-$350,000 in past due accounts. So we're not quite back where we were yet before COVID, but it is definitely going down. I think the highest that I saw in the report was January 22nd of 2021. It was almost $1.7 million. And we did receive the $652,000 from the arrearage program. We are sending back almost $20,000 to the state. Those are funds that weren't able to be applied to customers' accounts, either commercial accounts that didn't provide a W-9, which was required. So that money goes back to the state. And then some residential accounts where they were closed accounts, they had an opportunity to request that refund and they didn't within the time frame. So there's about $19,446 of that $652 that's going back to the state. Oh, sorry. That was my quick report on general reports.
Well, let me make sure no public comments first.
No public comment.
All right. Thank you. Go.
Thanks. Question about the sunsetting COVID policy. Do you have any thoughts on having a discussion about extension? Do you think it's needed?
Possibly. I know cases are going down. I don't know what, it could be in the future after September. Or if the state will impose any other regulations on us. But in our policy, the board does have authorization to extend those benefits, but that would be at the board's discretion.
Okay, so I'm assuming you'll come to us if you feel like that's a discussion that needs to be had.
Yes, I can do that.
Okay, thanks.
I'm good.
All right. I think that brings us to item 13. All right. That would be adjournment, folks. So thank you for you folks that, yeah. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. See you tomorrow.